Hey, this episode of the Majority Report is sponsored in part by our buddies over at SunsetLakeCBD.com. They helped us out on our fundraiser and wanted to just nod to them and thank them. They gave $1,000 to the GoFundMe for our support of Afghan refugees. And they're also having an end of summer sale. The whole month of September is in their end of summer sale. It is 50% off all hand-trimmed hemp flower, smalls, and keef. Matt just paid attention to the show.
That's what I'm talking about. That keef.
Like a week. He's like, wait, what? 50% off the smalls? The keef? Yeah, the sale runs through the end of the month of September. They are ramping up for their 2021 harvest season. So to celebrate 50% off all of their premium hemp flower, just use the code FLOWERPOWER at checkout. For everything else you got left is best. It gets you 20% off their gummies, their tinctures. They have tinctures now with CBD and melatonin. And they've got balm with arnica and CBD. They have coffee that has CBD in it. They have fudge. You got to check it out. All of their products, 100% pesticide free. They use integrated pest management, organic fertilizer, integrated farming practices, and they, with help of the University of Vermont, their business practices also great. $15 minimum wage. Company is mostly employee owned, and they are movement partners. So check them out. Left is best gets you 20% off. Flower Power gets you 50% off all of their premium hemp flower, their smalls, and their keef. So check it out, Flower Power at checkout. And also, don't forget that if you get on a subscription service with them, 25% off those products. So check it out, SunsetLakeCBD.com. If you check out our YouTube or our podcast description, you will get all of those promo codes and those deals there, SunsetLakeCBD.com. And now, time for the show.
Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, September 10th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept, also host of Hill's Rising, Ryan Grimm will be joining us to look back on the week that was, and in addition to that piece they broke in The Intercept about Joe Manchin's daughter. And then later in the program, Matthew Film Guy will join us. They reminisce a little bit about 9/11. Also on the program today, Joe Biden announces massive new testing and vaccination mandates, and right-wing heads explode, but the majority of U.S. citizens support that mandate. Meanwhile, the DOJ sues Texas over its abortion ban, and the sliced and diced reconciliation bill is making its way through five different House committees. We'll talk to Ryan Grimm about what he's heard the latest on that. Meanwhile, Joe Biden withdraws his alcohol, tobacco, firearms nominee, as the nominee was too anti-gun for, at the very least, Angus King from Maine and, of course, Joe Manchin. Air Force Inspector General says the Air Force and Space Force rife with sexual harassment and racial bias. Jair Bolsonaro bans social media from removing misinformation. Coincidentally, so does Governor Abbott in Texas.
Free speech in Brazil.
There you go. And lastly, Gavin Newsom seems to be polling well in the California recall campaign. Joe Biden will be the latest Democrat out there to campaign with him. All that and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Emma Vigeland continues her vacation. She will be back with us on Monday, as I will as well. Be back on Monday, but it's a little bit early to talk about Monday. We still have Friday to go. The big news, of course, is that the Biden administration announced last night sweeping vaccine mandates for federal workers, for federal contractors, and under the auspices of OSHA. This is the Safety and Health Administration, the Office of Safety, Health, and Administration in the federal government. This is the agency that says you must have proper ventilation for your workers in a pandemic. You must have other practices to maintain the safety and health of your employees. Well, they will issue another regulation, which is your employees, if you have a entity that is over 100 employees, must be vaccinated or must receive testing on a weekly basis. It's not so much a mandate for the private sector as much as it is an ultimatum on this regulation. Here is Joe Biden announcing this. In addition, there are other aspects of this, and here's Joe Biden.
We need to do more. This is not about freedom or personal choice. It's about protecting yourself and those around you, the people you work with, the people you care about, the people you love. My job as president is to protect all Americans. So tonight, I'm announcing that the Department of Labor is developing an emergency rule to require all employers with 100 or more employees that together employ over 80 million workers to ensure their workforces are fully vaccinated or show a negative test at least once a week. Some of the biggest companies are already requiring this. United Airlines, Disney, Tyson's Food, and even Fox News. The bottom line, we're going to protect vaccinated workers from unvaccinated coworkers. We're going to reduce the spread of COVID-19 by increasing the share of the workforce that is vaccinated in businesses all across America. My plan will extend the vaccination requirements that I previously issued in the healthcare field. Already, I've announced, we'll be requiring vaccinations at all nursing home workers who treat patients on Medicare and Medicaid because I have that federal authority. Tonight, I'm using that same authority to expand that to cover those who work in hospitals, home health care facilities, or other medical facilities, a total of 17 million health care workers. If you're seeking care at a health facility, you should be able to know that the people treating you are vaccinated. Simple, straightforward, period. Next, I will sign an executive order that will now require all executive branch federal employees to be vaccinated. All. And I've signed another executive order that will require federal contractors to do the same. If you want to work with the federal government and do business with us, get vaccinated.
There it is. And pretty big news. And I can tell you, you know, we'll talk more about this as the program goes on, but I can tell you that just even the healthcare stuff, personally, that is a big issue in my extended family. And I imagine that is the case for millions and millions of other Americans. We'll talk more about the political implications of this. Now, of course, the big news for the vast majority of us watching that clip is that there's going to be a vaccine mandate for federal workers and a vaccine, I guess, ultimatum for private workers. You gotta make sure you're tested or you get vaccinated. But for some, there was other news that became really surprising. Here is a tweet from Todd Starnes. He is on the Salem podcast.
Salem Radio Network.
Salem Radio Network. This is a right-wing radio network. And this is pretty sad stuff. Go ahead, show this. This is watching someone's heartbreak. Will you pop that up, that tweet? Here it is. Biden says that even Fox News has a mandatory vaccine policy, which incidentally was a great thing to drop in there. And in many respects, probably for the same reason. Is that true? Question mark. That can't be true. Have Hannity and Tucker and the others gotten the vaccine? That just can't be true. Heartbreaking to see someone. This is like when you know, where you tell people, you know, you never want to meet your heroes in real life. Yeah. It's one of those moments, right? Where frankly, I mean, this had been reported before, but nobody had made that much of a big deal about it, right? Because Tucker Carlson, whenever he was asked if he was vaccinated, claimed that was like asking someone, you know, what your favorite sexual position was for some reason. I have never worked at any place that has demanded I have a favorite sexual position or that they have said exactly what it should be.
I'm trying to remember if that was in that questionnaire I filled out prior to
when we hired you here. Yes, that was back at that time, maybe. But there's another theory, too, that Todd Starnes is still mad that he got fired from Fox News and wanted to make it clear to Fox News viewers that those people who are telling you that you didn't, you know, that the vaccine you should be skeptical of are actually huge, massive hypocrites. And in fact, have been all vaccinated themselves.
Yeah, they've been all taking it. I mean, Starnes was fired from Fox News because he claimed the Democrats do not believe in the Christian God and instead may worship Moloch, a pagan god synonymous with child sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, news guy.
I mean, he's willing to go there where, like,
he's willing to speak the truth.
Not.
And so, in other words, Fox News censored him.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, this censorship is...
Well, he's just asking questions. Why is there such a conspiracy in the media now to hide the fact that maybe Democrats worship Moloch?
The media rushes to judgment with their liberal groupthink, and it's horrible to watch.
Horrible to watch. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm, bureau chief at the D.C. Bureau of The Intercept. Folks, a couple of sponsors today. As you know, dinner time can be rather chaotic. Maybe you have a busy lifestyle. Maybe you have kids. Maybe you don't like to cook. Well, with Freshly, it's easy. Freshly's chefs take care of your meals a few nights a week, and they take the pressure off of you. Freshly offers chef-made, nutrient-packed, delicious meals delivered fresh to your door. You don't have any cooking to do. None required. With Freshly, your meals arrive cooked and fresh every week, so you can keep your fridge stocked and skip the trip to the store. Ordering, super easy. All you do is you go visit Freshly.com. You choose from over 30 meals, like steak peppercorn, sausage baked penne, and their chicken pesto bowl. Freshly, it can fit your lifestyle. They have a variety of plans. They have a bunch of different meals to pick from, and it all is catered towards your needs, towards your preferences, and towards your tastes. Your meals are ready to heat and enjoy in less than 3 minutes. For about 3 minutes. People know this story. I've told it many times on the program. When my sisters and I decided that my mom needed basically meals delivered to her, We wanted to make sure that she was eating properly and not having to cook. But we also knew that she wouldn't accept them from us if she thought we were paying for them. So my sister did research. She looked around for what was the highest rated meals. And we got Freshly. My mom loved it. And we told her that Freshly was a sponsor of the show and they'd give me a lifetime supply, which, of course, was a little bit of a fib. Then, coincidentally, a year later, Freshly reaches out to us and says, can we advertise, without knowing the story, obviously. And I told the story, and my mom found out that we'd been lying to her. But she loves the steak peppercorn, and that that trumped all. So right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to freshly.com/majority. Stop stressing about dinner. Go to freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. That's freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. Also, folks know that for a long time, I was against the use of deodorant. Why? Because I didn't want to put any of those chemicals in my system. And it was marginally successful. Sometimes I stunk. And so fortunately, I was introduced to Native. Because sometimes life stinks, sometimes you stink. And but with Native, you don't have to. Native is all about stopping the stink the right way. With products like their legendary aluminum-free deodorant. They also have body wash, toothpaste, and they have a brand new mineral-based sunscreen, which was huge for me when I went to the beach with Saul this past month. Wasn't greasy in any way, super easy to apply. He liked it. I liked it, obviously. Native's on a mission to overhaul your entire hygiene routine by putting the care in self-care with products that are carefully made to work against odor, that are made with simple ingredients and smell great. You can get their deodorant and body wash in amazing scents like coconut and vanilla, which happens to be Milo's favorite, citrus and herbal musk. I'm not a big musk fan myself, but the coconut and vanilla is fantastic. Or you can check out their new limited edition fall coffee house collection with scents like oat milk latte, matcha, and sweet cream. And for me, they have the Native deodorant that is unscented. You can even build your own personalized product bundles and mix and match through your favorite scents. Honestly, I couldn't be happier with Native. Like I say, I like the unscented, but I also feel great that I'm not putting that stuff in my body. Stay fresh, stay clean with Native by going to nativedeo.com/majority report or use the promo code majority report at checkout. You get 20% off your first order. That's nativedeo.com/majority report or promo code majority report at checkout. You get 20% off your first order. And lastly, not going to reiterate the story of my having food poisoning this week, but I will tell you it was a revelation to have my Hello Tushy modern bidet on my toilet this week.
Bringing the big guns.
Exactly. I had never contemplated the implications of my my bidet when it came to something like food poisoning, but I can tell you, winner. Winner, I guess bad chicken dinner really would be. But Tushy is the modern bidet for people who, you know, go to the bathroom and poop. You just poop, you wash, you pat dry. The Tushy bidet washes your bum with water for a better clean than toilet paper. Washing with water, I can tell you, much less irritating, much more soothing for your body, particularly that part.
I mean, you can't wash with paper.
No, you can't. Tushy bidet is easy to install, super easy to install. It attaches to the toilet in under 10 minutes, no electricity needed, no plumbing needed. Using a Tushy bidet reduces your toilet paper use by 80%. It saves you money. It is eco-friendly. It is stylish. And it really is a revelation. Start washing with a Tushy bidet for a better clean. Go to hellotushy.com/majority and get 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for our listeners at hellotushy.com/majority. 10% off after you buy and install your Tushy. Show it off. tagged at Hello Tushy on Instagram. All right. Want to welcome back to the program DC Bureau Chief of The Intercept, also host of the Hill's Rising YouTube Daily Show, Ryan Grimm. Ryan, welcome back to the program.
See you, Sam.
I want to talk about your big story that you guys ran the other day about Joe Manchin's daughter. But first, let's talk about the mandate. That's obviously the big news of the day. This is a big deal, I think, both from a policy, public health policy standpoint, and also I think what is really not, I think, appreciated. This is a big political move too for Joe Biden. What's your sense of this?
Yes, I think it is. It's a huge political move. What you want to talk about the politics of it?
Well, broadly speaking, from a policy standpoint, I think it makes some sense, right? I mean, we're watching state by state, yeah, where the vaccination rates are lower, go into crisis mode about their ICU. I think there's even more data than there was a couple of months ago that the vaccination A protects you from the Delta variant in terms of catching it, but also enormous protection in terms of getting seriously ill. I mean, so from the public policy standpoint, I think it's pretty clear why you do this, but let's talk about the politics behind this.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So on the one hand, I think they resisted doing this as long as possible. You know, they were hoping that this surge, that there would not be a surge. They were hoping, like the rest of us were, that in the spring, that it was going to wane. We're going to have a hot girl summer. We're moving on with our lives and everything's opening up. That didn't happen. Thousands of people dying a day. And so on the one hand, you know, they're pushed into this situation. But I do think actually there is an argument to be made that the politics work out for them. Now, they're certainly going to anger some segment of the population, that and some segment of that population aligns with Democrats. So it'll be interesting to see if there's any reaction in the California recall. Like, let's see if anybody gets, any voters there get pissed at Democrats and come out and cast a protest vote.
Okay. So wait a second. The people that they piss off, you've got a Venn diagram, right, of people who would vote for Democrats. And we're not talking about intensity here. We're just talking about if someone could show up at their door and say, here's a ballot and please, I'm not going to leave until you vote. Mm-hmm. You got a Venn diagram, right? You get the circle of people who are going to vote for Democrats. You get the circle of people who are going to vote for Republicans. Do you think there's really any significant number of people who would vote for Democrats who would be mad about this mandate at this point?
I wouldn't rule it out. I think it's possible. I think it's far outweighed by the number of people who are going to be excited and enthusiastic about it. And I think it's outweighed by the number of people on the Republican side who avoiding a vaccine has become part of their identity.
Right.
And we're going to be angry anyway. And so that was the other point that I was getting to, that the interesting politics here are that what this, and the way he framed it also, like the way he framed his speech was aimed
at triggering. Let's play this clip. We have this clip. This is where he does it, because I think there's two things that are going on here. I mean, there's one, this is a wedge issue in some respects, right? Because you've got 65 to 70% of the population, mm-hmm, who are already double vaccinated, 65%, and around the exact same number who are in favor of a mandate. I don't think it's much of a coincidence, right? But here's how he framed it. Here, play this clip.
My message to unvaccinated Americans is this. What more is there to wait for? What more do you need to see? We've made vaccinations free, safe, and convenient. The vaccine has FDA approval. Over 200 million Americans have gotten at least one shot. We've been patient, but our patience is wearing thin, and your refusal has cost all of us. So please do the right thing. But just don't take it from me. Listen to the voices of unvaccinated Americans who are lying in hospital.
All right, that's
beds.
Good. I think we get the point. I mean, because, I mean, there he is saying something that I think, like, probably 150 million Americans have said at one point or another, like almost word for word, right?
Right. What are you waiting for? Right. And he did not have to frame it that way. Like, there was an Obama-esque version of that speech that he could have given that would have used lots of passive voice and, you know, tried to coax people into the light. He didn't do that. He's like, what are you waiting for? Like, you're messing this whole thing up for everybody else. Like, it's just, that's practically a quote. Like,
yeah.
And so there's a choice in framing it that way. And the political result of framing it that way is that you isolate this minority of people, and you polarize the country around that minority. If all you do is watch cable news, you might think this is a 50-50 question, which the politics of isolating a question, a 50-50 question, are very different,
right,
than isolating a 70-30 or 80-20 or even 65-35 question. And Democrats very rarely take the opportunity to polarize around an issue where they're in the vast majority. And not, and once you polarize it, then you also then trigger the most extreme voices. So this minority, half of whom have reasonable skepticism and fear about the unknown, but then the other half, who are just nutso, like, identity driven opponents, those are the ones who are going to be loudest. And so then the rest of the country, who's like, what are you waiting for, just sees them as that much nuttier, and they continue to become even more isolated, and then they continue to grow their majority. That would be the theory, at least.
Right. I mean, this is the functional equivalent of the Biden administration appointing Marjorie Taylor Greene as the majority leader in the House.
Right.
Right? I mean,
or like Hillary getting Trump nominated.
Right. Well, yes, right. I mean, that's the downside of this. And, right. and the Obama administration, the Obama did that too. If you remember, in 2009, they touted Rush Limbaugh as the intellectual pillar of the Republican Party. I mean, you remember those first mm-hmm. 6 months? I mean, Rush Limbaugh was the only Republican they would address almost on some level. Mm-hmm. So there's some times where it works and some times where it doesn't. and that's the thing about this, which is tough to predict. And it makes it sort of a bold move by the Biden White House in the way that they approach this, because this seems like it to me, it is more of a no-brainer if we are going into a general election as opposed to a midterm election, right? Because a midterm election is about enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And the question is, you know, are you making the anti-vaxxers, which the overlay, in my estimation, you know, that Venn diagram, and I'm talking the anti-vaxxers, not the people who are saying it's been inconvenient, or I just haven't had the time, or I'm afraid to take off time from work, because this addresses that for a lot of those people, because there's a mandate for employers to give people time off, paid time off, mm-hmm. to get vaccinated and to deal with the fallout from it, which I think is really important. But in terms of that anti-vaxxer group, they were already going to come out and vote against, right, you know, in this midterm election. And maybe you've sealed a deal. I don't know that you've motivated pro-vaccination mandate people enough with this, but that's an attempt to do it, right? Mm-hmm. By not making it a passive thing, by saying, like, I'm protecting the grievance of the rest of us who are like, we want to get this thing over with, and you guys are out there saying, like, I don't know, mm-hmm. ivermectin is the way, is the panacea or something.
Yeah, it gives them something to fight for. It gives that, because the complacency is the thing that creates all of these midterm backlashes after a party comes into power. Like, the political science is kind of in on that. The majority party's voters are happy that their man is in the White House, And so they don't show up, enough of them, like a 10% or what, you know, a significant number don't show up because they're good. We're fine. What do we need to, what do we care? I'm busy. I got better things to do. The party that's out is angry that, you know, every single day is another microaggression, seeing this person in the White House. And so they get motivated to go out. And so this, I think, gives some motivation to the majority, like to Democrats, to go out and show that they're, because they're pitted in this fight. You know, what makes the political science not necessarily reliable going forward is that we're in such a tense time now that everything is fraught and being fought out in a way that it wasn't before.
Right.
And so if this culture war, and it's a culture war, like he's polarizing it around culture. If this culture war is going to be decided at the midterms, then you can't ever rest on your laurels in a culture war. You know, if it's all just politics or electoral politics and your party controls the White House, you can take it easy. But if it's an ongoing culture war, you've got to constantly keep coming out. And so that could have an influence on turnout, I think, in a way that this time benefits Democrats.
Yes. I mean, what's fascinating about this is, right, there's two big elements that we don't know. I mean, again, you know, if the election was this November instead of a year from November, things obviously would be clearer. But the Republicans are organizing around these anti-mask, you know, like anti-mask and anti-vax. It's quite possible that because of this vaccine mandate, 6 months from now, to come out and say, like, I'm against masks, everybody will be like, well, yeah, but we're not wearing them anymore.
Right, cool, good. Yeah, me too.
the pandemic's mostly over now. And so
the variants are the variant.
Well, of course, that's exactly. Right. We don't know. And so it's possible, you know, the thing that makes this both like a political weapon to wield and a good public policy could also make it a political weapon that sort of diffuses where the Republicans have placed all their eggs in the basket, right? Like they're not going to get the same sort of salience out of Joe Biden seems to be a fuddy-duddy. And right. We got to get really angry about this. All the anger is coming from the anti-mask van, you know, anti-maskers and the anti-vaxxers. And if 6 to 8 months from now, you know, the country is a lot like, let's say, New York, in terms of what we're seeing for or less. The Republicans it's going to be hard for them to find something to get angry about.
Because if you're everyone's against masking and everyone's against locking down in a time when you don't have to do it.
Right.
So if they're like, let's stop wearing masks, I'm against lockdowns, no more lockdowns, you're like, well, there is no lockdown, we're not wearing masks. I think that's exactly right. No, if that is the situation in November 2022, and let's say it you know, the pandemic eases because the variants burned out, Delta is like ticking downward right now. I mean, hopefully we're at the peak and it's coming down. They also might have timed it for now so that they can causally point to their intervention and say, look, here's the date, you know, and you'll see these charts and they'll be disingenuous in some ways.
Right.
But like, look at, it's just like, you can look now at the chart of January 20th inauguration. It's like the peak of the entire pandemic so far is like January 20th. 20,
right, and as soon as Biden got in, he was able to drop it.
But it's disingenuous to be like, look, Biden himself like dragged this down. But you'll see a little dot. Biden introduces vaccine mandate, and then you'll see Delta numbers coming down. If they stay down and flatten out, and then restrictions are lifted, I think you're right that the politics all militate toward him.
I imagine this time around, too, the Biden administration is going to be a little bit slower to roll out the mission accomplished banner because, you know, one of the depressing things about this, you know, by the time we got to July was like in May, it looked like Mm-hmm. It's going to be the summer of love, and it didn't work out that way. The other element that could be interesting to work into this is sort of like a little bit tangential, although Jim Jordan, I think it was this week, hinted at this, is that we're talking about negative partisanship driving poll number, driving people to the polls. Between now and the midterm, Donald Trump could be running for re-election, and that was then all of a sudden we get to like a almost like a rough facsimile of 2018, right, where you can vote against Donald Trump today before even running by coming out and voting against him in the midterm.
It'll be the second time Democrats are rooting for Trump to run for president.
Well, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But this time there's no risk that he'll be elected in 2022.
Exactly.
So exactly. In their short-term interest, they're like, yeah, come on out. And I think the more that they polarize around these more extreme issues, the harder it does get for him, to win in 2024. But like we already saw them,
I think there is you don't have to sell the idea to Democrats that Donald Trump can win.
Right.
I mean, that was also a big factor. It wasn't just that they wanted Donald Trump to run. It was that they didn't think he could win.
Yeah.
This time around, I think there would be a little more savvy about that. All right.
So, like they were in 2020.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And so let's turn from that, because the other thing that, and it's fun to be able to talk about things where there's a political advantage for Democrats and a massive public policy advantage for all of us, and moving from the vaccine mandate to, what's winding through Congress as we speak. There are five committees that are, looking at different aspects of the $3.5 trillion budget bill, the reconciliation bill. And here's how I tie in on your story. Joe Manchin comes out last week or end of last week, maybe beginning of this week, and says, yeah, I'm looking at something that's more like $1 trillion. I could see myself going up to $1.5 trillion, but $3.5 trillion we couldn't possibly do because mumble, something inflation, mumble.
National security and the deficit.
Security. I don't know what else comes after those words, but it's just sort of mumble. Institutions, Senate, something. Like, first off, what's your sense? And there was already, I think Stephanie Murphy came out and said from Florida in the House that she's going to vote against it already because it's not, she doesn't have enough time to read it. What's your sense of where it's, what's the state of play in the House and, the Senate? And then let's talk about the implications of your, blockbuster story, because, people say Joe Biden, LBJ. Well, LBJ, seems to me, would
he'd know what to do with
it. He'd know what to do with that story, it seems to me. But,
so then the House, I think, yes, Stephanie Murphy, likely no. Kurt Schrader, former head of the Blue Dogs, I think is a pretty solid no. Jared Golden, lean no, but like gettable. But then everybody else, pretty much everybody else is a likely, is gettable. Like those are the two.
And they have a margin of three, right?
Although they have Alcee Hastings' seat is open and Chantel Brown will win in November. And the Ohio governor, did an incredible job screwing Democrats in keeping that seat open as long as humanly possible.
Right.
Which there were plenty of other people to run HUD. Like Biden didn't need to. And Pelosi finally was like, stop. Like after he plucked Deb Haaland out of the House, she's like, stop. Like, right. What are you doing?
You're making my job much harder because you're giving me a much thinner margin.
And then if somebody dies, like Alcee Hastings, right. That election So, the, you know, their cushion grows the longer they wait. But the longer they wait, the harder it gets. So they, you know, it's still alive, but yes. So in the Senate, it's Biden, you know, it's Manchin and Sinema, but with Manchin really stealing a lot of that thunder, a lot of that spotlight. And yeah, so he said, he doesn't want to do 3.5 trillion, one to 1.5. And he even said in the Wall Street Journal, anybody who thinks this is political posturing should just consider the words of Admiral Mike Mullen, who said that national security is compromised by the deficit. It's like, you set us up there like you're about to say something important. And then you finish the sentence.
With the deficit.
But Mike Mullen talking about the deficit?
What
does he know about the deficit?
But now, wait a second. See, here's the thing that I don't even understand that as a talking point, because is the reconciliation bill, at least in the context of like 10 years out. Now, we know there's all sorts of gimmicks and whatnot and, you know, associated with this. But my understanding is, like, doesn't that have to be deficit neutral under the reconciliation rules? Or no, it does not.
It doesn't. It's whatever you write into the rules.
Okay.
And so the tax cut that Trump did was allowed to be, I forget what exactly, but like 1.6 trillion under the deficit. Like, so it's whatever you write into the, so it could actually include $6.5 trillion in spending. And as long as it had $3 trillion in pay for us, is I think my understanding of how this, I haven't read these instructions, but that would be in line with how instructions like this would be passed. So it doesn't have to be deficit neutral. It's whatever you write into the instructions.
And there's not going to be $3.5 trillion of new revenue, although...
It could be.
Well, man, that's the thing.
That's the rub, yeah.
That's the thing is that, you know, and we should be clear here. I mean, you know, because I know a lot of our viewers are, you know, modern monetary theorists. And there's two ways in which you use taxes. One is to placate people who say you need to pay for something. And then the other is to basically deal with wealth inequality and to discourage behavior that you don't want to have to take place. And so today, read a report that Sherrod Brown and Ron Wyden are going to introduce a provision to tax stock buybacks, which stock buybacks are very problematic. Part of a sort of a real, I think, drag on the functioning of corporations that you combine with the changes in capital gains taxes and the idea of stock buybacks back in the early 80s under Reagan. And you start having board of directors and C-suite people basically having a cottage industry, which is a side bet to what their company is actually doing. Like, you know, I can make all my money by just simply, you know, increasing our profits by cutting our workers. The health of the company, you know, 5-10 years from now is not really an issue to my pay because I'm tied to the stock price, and the stock price isn't necessarily associated with the health of my company 10, 15, 20 years down the road, and certainly not the community or anything else. You know, to tax the stock buybacks, you know, deals with wealth inequality and also sort of like changes a, you know, realigns some incentives when it comes to corporate governance. And so what does a Joe Manchin do at that point where if people are like, well, you know, you're worried about the deficit, you know, okay, let's tax more.
Well, what he does is tries to push down the spending number so that there's less pressure on Congress to come up with those types of taxes. And so I think that's basically what's going on here. He doesn't.
That's his two-step. He's worried. He doesn't want the taxes.
But he can't say that.
Pretending it's about the spending.
Right. Yes, I think that's exactly right. Yeah.
And we have there was also a story about Heidi Heitkamp out doing a similar thing on this. And it's a little bit complicated in terms of like the stepped up basis for inheritance tax. But if, if mom or dad owns a house and they give it to me and they bought it for $200,000 and now it's worth $2 million. They give it to me at $2 million. And anything above that is what I got to pay taxes on, essentially, if I sell it, as opposed to like, wait, this is accrued by the capital gains has gone up. And Heitkamp said that was a racket to get rid of that. And then
right. And there's all sorts of exceptions for property and for those types of hand downs or whatever you call it. The more common scenario is somebody inherits a trust with filled with common stock worth $20 million that, you know, is made up of $15 million of which is capital gains. And so if the dad had sold it, you know, would owe $5 million.
Right.
Now, because he died and passed it down, that's wiped out. And now all of this GE stock or this Apple stock, it's as if you just bought it today. Even though you're the kid or the grandkid of the person who bought it, and all of that's gone. So that like when people would much rather talk about a family farm like Heitkamp wants to do, even though farms are just like we've heard that talking point so many times that they've written into the law a million times. It's not going to take your farm.
Right.
It's like right in that. That's practically the legislative language. Stop worrying about your farm. It's not about your farm. It's about your Apple stock, or whatever.
And it's Apple stock that's like over at least $2 million worth, right?
You get $2 million worth that was bought in like 1985. Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, let's talk about the story that you guys did. You broke about Joe Manchin's daughter. Her name is Heather Bresch, right? Mm-hmm. Tell us about this story, because this, it seems to me, should, if I'm Joe Manchin, one would hope Joe Manchin would be like, hey, I'm not going to make too much of a stink right now. Maybe the opposite, but tell us the story.
Well, Mylan Pharmaceuticals is currently the distributor of EpiPen, and it's for years it was a kind of the pride of Morgantown. You know, this homegrown West Virginia pharmaceutical company that trafficked in a lot of generics, like really making the world a better place, like producing cheap, you know, affordable medications for people. So Heather Bresch gets a job working for them in the 2000s. 2007, she gets promoted to chief operating officer, which is the first scandal that hits the family, because she had been claiming for a long time that she had this executive business degree and a master's from West Virginia University. And so like a good local paper, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, because it's Pittsburgh's like the biggest city near there, called West Virginia University. You can call the registrar and ask about anybody's degree. I once called, asked if Yusuf Aloteba had actually graduated from Georgetown, like he claims to have. He's the ambassador from the UAE. They're like, nope, he didn't. Like, oh, good. Nice little nugget from my profile there. And so they're like, no, she's like halfway there. Like, she's not even close. It's not like, oh, she didn't turn in her final paper. Not even close. So Pittsburgh paper reports that. Then they get a call from the school. There was a mistake. The governor's daughter, in fact, did.
Manchin was governor at the time.
Manchin's governor in his second term.
Coincidence?
Yes. He did. Oh, no. The end of his first term. So they run this correction. We're sorry. How could we have done this? She does have a master's degree. Enough people knew that she did not, because she wasn't even close, that they then had to. There were protests at the school. They had to do an actual investigation where they hired an independent kind of legal team to like look into it. And they found that the school, in response to the paper, had like actively just fabricated grades and classes and everything to like give her this degree. It led to the resignations of all the top leadership at West Virginia University, a huge college. The only consequence for Bresch was that she no longer listed that on her bio on file.
You got to go back. You got to get copies of your CV. I mean, that's not nothing, right?
You got to update your LinkedIn. So she continued rising. She becomes CEO shortly thereafter, president and CEO of Mylan Pharmaceuticals. Manchin's wife, her mother, becomes the top lobbyist for the Association of School Boards, which will become relevant in a second. So Mylan owned the right to distribute EpiPen. The medicine was actually made by this other company, which was getting purchased by Pfizer. Pfizer also made a competitor, kind of a generic-ish competitor called Adrenaclick. So now Mylan was facing the possibility that Pfizer is going to own not just part of EpiPen, but also own this generic-ish competitor to it. And so I got an email that the subject of which is our discussion, and it's from Heather Bresch to Ian Reed, who is the CEO of Pfizer. She's saying, just wanted to confirm our discussion that after your purchase of King Pharmaceutical, that you're going to divest from Adrenaclick. Just want to make sure we're all in the same, because I saw you close today. She's wasting no time.
What does that mean, divest from my, like, what are the implications of that company basically goes under?
What it meant is they pulled Adrenaclick off the market.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what they ultimately did later that year, in fact. So
in other words, there's no competitor to EpiPen.
Right. Right.
Now that you've bought the supplier of the medicine that goes inside the EpiPen, you're going to get rid of the other distribution mechanism in the click. And so that we're going to have no competitor and you're going to have no, you're going to be our sole supplier. So we've created this sort of monopoly on both levels.
Right.
And then it's just off to the races, because what happens to the price of EpiPen that went from $100, right? To
well over $600. And then, instantly, as this is going on, in fact, her executive team comes up with the idea, since people are going to die, if they don't use the EpiPen immediately when they need it, why are we allowing them to just buy one? Like, if we force them to buy two, they will buy two rather than die. And internally, they're writing about it in language like that. Like, this is a matter of life or death for people. They will purchase two if we force them to. And so they concoct this, what they call Project X2, which is to eliminate the single EpiPen pack. And they're not selling you two of them, for the price of one or two at a discount. They're just doubling the price and forcing you to buy two. I got an email from a sales associate to the medical team saying, hey, I need a quote medical rationale for this, because I'm supposed to present this to Heather. And then later I got an email from the CEO saying the medical folks say that we can't really use medical guidelines to drive this, because it's not true.
Right. There's actually no reason why, from a medical standpoint, why you need two EpiPens as opposed to one EpiPen.
If you're a patient, you'd probably rather have two in case one misfires or something. I could understand why somebody would want to have two, but you don't need to have two. And if you're doubling the price and you're keeping it from somebody, that's probably worse. So they push this through. They talk to Pfizer, and I have emails say Pfizer's all in. They like this idea. Somebody says, "What about the FDA?" And somebody else says, "Don't call or write the FDA, because it would raise more questions than we have answers."
And this is a classic, better to apologize than ask permission type of scenario.
And somebody's like, "What about all the payers, the insurers?" And they're like, "Well, we're under $1 billion in revenue. I think we'll quote fly under the radar." Like, so they're conspiring to conceal the scheme from the regulators and from the people that are going to be paying for it. And what's so amazing to me is that it shows how endemic this stuff is in the industry, that they would just be hashing this out over email.
Right. They don't feel like as sort of like grotesque as this is, and arguably illicit, right?
Mm-hmm. No. You could easily have. In fact, they're getting sued for it right now, and plenty of those plaintiffs' attorneys would say this borders into criminal territory.
And so the idea that they don't even feel like we need to hide our tracks, it's more like this is not like, would imagine like the CEO of the company would not be laying it out there.
Now, there's no record in the exhibits of Ian Reed replying to that email. So he might have been like, "Oh, Jesus Christ.
We
talked about this on the phone.
Never
for
email.
A reason. What are you doing?" So yeah, the price went up over $600. She then did face some scrutiny in 2016 when it hit that number. Oh, and Gail Manchin then lobbied all of these school districts to require these schools to purchase EpiPens. So that helped drive up the price too. So she did appear in front of Congress, but at the time there wasn't this evidence of her, you know, of her directly talking about this discussion with Ian Reed. This only came out through a unsealed as part of this court case last week. So it really ties it all together and links it with the Project X 2. Because right, like, and the other salesperson is also like saying that this is medically necessary. Also, is a bit inconsistent because we're only doing it in the U.S.
Well, you know, the Europeans, they have a different
different allergies,
exactly. Yeah. The EpiPen, and we should say so. Bresch leaves right in after the investigations into this, and. Sadly, only got like a $30 million payout,
$36 million or something. So, and actually, the company was sold to Pfizer. So Pfizer just gobbled the whole thing up, and then it's now Viatris, I think, is the company that owns this part of Mylan. And so they, at the same month that Bresch left with her $30+ million package, closed down the Morgantown plant. 1,500 jobs lost. So it's not even that all of this corruption and self-dealing at least creates 1,500 jobs for people in Morgantown. Like, the plant is getting closed. And it's like, come on, Manchin. Like, you can't, like, you can ask for anything you want in this reconciliation package. If you ask for $50 million a year for the next 100 years, like, to keep this plant going, producing generics, doing research for West Virginia University, that Schumer would give that to you before you could finish asking for it.
Right. Okay. So with all this said, I mean,
call it the Heather Bresch.
Well, research. That's actually, yes, we were talking about that, right? Like the, what was it? The Cornhusker kickback.
Right.
And what else do they call it? The Florida flimflam.
The Louisiana Purchase.
The Louisiana Purchase, the Florida flimflam, and the Cornhusker kickback were the things that the right wing were talking about when it came to the ACA, I think. I think that's what John McCain was actually calling them at the time. You know, it's a way of trying to maybe distance himself from his savings and loans issue. Yes. Back in the day, his Keating 7 or whatever it was. And so, all right, well... All right, so let me ask you this. I mean, and I should say the story that you've written is both. It's an amazing insight into what's going on with the pharmaceuticals as to like why we pay so much for these pharmaceuticals. I mean, you know, these are not like bit players. Pfizer is not a big player.
They're a big deal.
They're a big deal. And you know, they're just a little more sophisticated. Like, you don't use the email, folks. Like, you know, you don't send emails. You don't do it that way. I don't. That probably went in my spam folder, is what they probably are trained to say at that point. And I never saw it.
Don't remember that discussion. Yeah,
I don't remember that phone call at all. And it also talks about the obvious corruption that is associated with Joe Manchin. I don't think it was a coincidence that West Virginia University calls back and says, "Actually, no, we wrote out all these grades." So. Like, how does this get leveraged at this point? I mean, you know, look, it's gross that these things are not, you know, there's no accountability for it, but there's not going to be. So the question becomes, like, how do we take this lemon, which is Joe Manson's, family is incredibly corrupt, and turn it into some lemonade where that ultimately leads to an expansion of Medicare, better Medicare services, home health care, and paid sick leave, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Manchin's objective here is to come out of this in a better political position than he went into it. So to the extent that that's not happening, then that disincentivizes whatever behavior he's engaging in is the way I would put it. And I think Daniel Boguslaw at The Intercept also did a really good piece the week before investigating his coal empire, because people don't realize after he was elected to the state the House of Delegates in West Virginia, he then opened a coal company. He launched his own coal brokerage firm. And, you know, which is a common pastime of West Virginia politicians. You do the politics first, and that leads to the wealth. And so that's that. Those companies are now owned or operated, or they're now operated by Joe Manchin the fourth, Joe Manchin, who is Joe Manchin's son. But Manchin himself is still a major owner. He's reported more than $4 million in income, you know, from these coal businesses since he's been elected to the Senate. He's making every year something like $500,000 from these businesses. He says he put them in a blind trust, but if it's a company that you own, what does that mean?
Yeah.
As you know,
I'm no longer doing business decisions, but you know it's a coal company. Right. So you're going to do stuff so that the coal business, just broadly speaking, is benefited because you have a coal business. I mean, it's really just sort of like, I don't know. I have an ice cream business, but I have no say on how they operate. I'm just making the laws as to what constitutes good nutrition. And I just happen to think it's ice cream.
And I think sherbet should be banned.
Exactly.
I just do. It's gross.
It's gross. It's meal.
Get the froyo out of here.
It's not really a dessert thing. So, I mean,
Right. So if his motivations appear to be driven by support for the pharmaceutical industry, which his family's making tens of million dollars and engaged in possibly illegal schemes, and his family's making millions of dollars from the coal industry, that drains some of the energy out of his like attempts to portray himself as this person who's just looking out for the deficit here.
To whom does that, like, I mean, like, who's the audience that he's playing?
Right. It has to become a dominant public narrative. Like, you'd have to have MSNBC, Rachel Maddow and Chris Hayes, Lawrence O'Donnell. Like, it's not impossible, but they'd have to decide to cover
story.
They'd have to decide to cover politics in a way that includes that is more holistic than the media tends to cover politics.
Well,
it's, you know, the media covers politics as a horse race and as a competition between competing ideas.
Right.
As conservatives and liberals and moderates and deficit hawks, and as opposed to this is a coal baron,
right?
And a pharmaceutical executive's dad, you know, who has particular interests at play here.
All right. Well, there it is. Anybody's listening back at MSNBC, this will be on the choice, but not necessarily have the same range as it would if the varsity team took it up. Ryan Grimm, thank you so much. We'll put a link to these stories. People should pass these stories around. Send them to your favorite news host and have them repeat them. Ryan, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Real pleasure.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Right back and finish this up. I mean, one of the things I think is very difficult for people to wrap their heads around. I mean, I have been doing this for 16, 17 years, and I still have trouble wrapping my heads around, like, how greedy these people are and how much they're motivated by their own enriching themselves, our politicians, and, like, you know, a couple million. Okay, but, like, do you really need more? Like, are you really willing to trade?
Politics has worked well for Manchin. His daughter got that job because when he had that coal consultancy and he was a state senator, he was sitting next to the Mylan CEO at a West Virginia Mountaineers basketball game and said, "Hey, my daughter needs a job." And she got a job.
I mean, Your daughter's set. Dude, go on, you know, go retire, for God's sakes. I just don't get it. But find that Intercept story. We'll put a link to it and spread it around, folks. For those of you watching us on Peacock, we will see you on Monday. And for the rest of you, we're going to have Matthew Film Guy on, well, I guess just after we play the thing I'm going to drink about. Yeah, let's play it now. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, check out Left Reckoning. Why don't you tell us what's on Left Reckoning?
Oh, yeah, we had Brian Muir talking about Bolsonaro's bus bozos in front of the Supreme Court this week. We also talked about, actually, the story, Ryan Grimm, about the EpiPens, and we went deeper into the West Virginia fake business degree. And we also talked about, I forget the other thing we talked about, but we talked about a third thing. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get the post game where we talk about Terry Albury, the FBI whistleblower, who has some interesting insights into how, I guess, racially sensitive FBI agents are, which is to say, not much. Wanting to sue Obama for not having a white History Day, that sort of thing.
Oh, my God.
So that's on the Patreon. So patreon.com/leftreckoning. We're closing in on 900 patrons.
I love how she can lie about her degree, and the blowback on that is she gets promoted and then ultimately gets a $36 million golden parachute.
Yeah, yeah, it's 37.6 actually. And the funny thing about it is, like, when she's asked, she's like, "Can the Pittsburgh Post Gazette was like, can we get a copy of your transcripts to see what you got?" And they're like, "No, actually, I think my word and the word of the university is actually all that you need."
That's it. That's right. It's nice. You don't need anything specific. Yeah. All right. Let's. I'm going to bring Matthew down. We'll bring in. I guess I got to get rid of that, like, that thing in between the two desks.
Didn't quite work out.
Hold on. Just take it easy, Matthew. Just take it easy, buddy. There we go.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing your streams. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such things. Maybe you'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie to stream.
So yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is Matthew Film Guy, and let me just pull the curtain behind, curtain back on the inner workings of the show and the way that we book this. Now, originally, I had pre-taped Russ Feingold, former Senator Russ Feingold, and was intending to play it today. We were going to have Grimm on yesterday. But the last minute, Grimm had to cancel, which, you know, happens rarely. Happens a lot with a guy like Grimm, actually. I'm not going to lie. I think it's like the third time he's done that in the history of the show. Now, he's been on the show, you know, more times than most people. So, and he's busy. And so I was like, we made like a late call, like around, I don't know, 11 a.m. or 11:30 even, to say, like, let's run the Feingold interview. You know, it's tomorrow, September 10th, September 9th is just as legitimate and this and that. And it'll make sense to talk about the week in politics with Grimm. And there's going to be this vaccine mandate and et cetera, et cetera. And I thought maybe I'll talk to Grimm about 9/11. We ran out of time and all the things that happened. And then just over the course of the week, I'm like, who are we going to have on this weekend? I can't remember. When was the last time Matthew was on? We'll have Matthew on. And then I forgot that, like, you know, you're an appropriate sort of 9/11 20th anniversary guest to have on for the second, you know, like the sort of the fun half-ish, because, you know, our work together was very much implicated by 9/11. I mean, that, you know, that... our the forging of our friendship was very much around, pivoted around 9/11 in a weird way, didn't it?
It did indeed. And, you know, and just in general, I'm the perfect substitution for Feingold. That's, I've done that many times.
You missed.
He and I are, I mean,
No.
I mean, I think of me when I think of.
You're not the substitution for Feingold. I'm saying that if I had somebody in this.
That's going on my resume.
You know, wanted to talk about 9/11. You're the most appropriate person. That just worked out that way.
He and I both took a principled stand against the USA Patriot Act. I think that's one thing we have in common. All right, let's not list all the things I have in common with Feingold.
I think we just
did. Yeah, indeed. That's just the start of it, but I won't go into it. Indeed, Sam. You know, we were in the midst of.
When I texted you yesterday?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you
absolutely
sent me that video.
It did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We can discuss that. But yeah, you know, we had just gotten off the set of a film, a comedy about terrorism being enacted against tall buildings in New York City. And lo and behold, the shit happened for real.
Yeah.
And it definitely put a crimp in both of our careers. Let's just get at the top. What was the main problem?
Right. I mean, this is on some level, you know, like talking about it. But, you know, that's the thing is that we had Feingold on. And so it's, you know, not like we haven't addressed the topic in it's really sort of the most important way. But this is our sort of our lighter thing. I can't help but think of Sarah Silverman's joke about 9/11, which, if I recall, was something to the effect that, and this was, you know, sort of, you know, the. After 9/11, there was a big thing in comedy. Do you remember that? Like, you know, irony is dead, and when is it appropriate to talk about it? And Sarah had a joke, and I can't remember when she came out with it, but it was like, I'm never going to forget 9/11. That's the day my boyfriend dumped me, and that was like...
That was in Jesus's Magic, yeah.
Yeah.
And they just came out with a documentary. I don't know if you heard about it. I haven't seen it, called A Too Soon, that basically is about interviewing comedians about how they got back into doing comedy after 9/11 and what that whole scene was like. I think Maron may have been interviewed for
I haven't heard about that, but
I mean, listen, it's gallows humor is a very legitimate form of healing. I find it suits me. It worked for me at the time. I mean, at the time we were just completely just traumatized. It's the only word for it. But as soon as we could find some way to you know, cope with the horrors, I know I took it. So that's definitely part of the process.
Yeah. So we should just say, for people who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, in the winter of 2001, somewhere around, like, I guess must have been about, well, it was probably like in February, March, actually. It was after that, actually. So I had done a character in the run-up to the 2000 election. Alan Lieberman, I think it was. And he was
Arthur.
Joe, huh?
Don't make me have to remember your own character. Lieberman?
No, Arthur was in the movie, but for some reason I changed it from Alan to Arthur. I don't know why.
Oh.
And I had done this character, Al Lieberman. And it was, you know, one of my sort of like anti-comedy bits where Joe Lieberman's ne'er-do-well son would go up and try and do stand-up. And I think at one point, like, I went with Janine to Syracuse University and I would set up the video cameras to shoot the audience as I would do this. And I would just come out and say, like, you know, you got to vote for my dad. And there was a whole story about how he was a tennis pro in West Palm Beach and was pushing it. And in fact, that night of the election, I called into the best show on FMU. It was very, very early. I think that Tom Sharpling had launched that show. It was on a Tuesday night, was the election, obviously. And I was on the phone with him as Al Lieberman. And basically developed the character there, you know, in that moment, but also had been doing it as stand-up. And when the Supreme Court decided, you know, Bush v. Gore, I had a lot of trouble with that. And I ended up writing sort of a script that I had already had sort of laid out for a New York Liberation Front, I think it was, and intertwined it with this story. And it... It was a weird story. It was a weird story, but it involved,
I liked it.
It involved Joe Lieberman's fictional son at the end firing a bazooka at a building in New York City.
And after he was radicalized by the Orthodox Jewish postal workers played by John Benjamin and Mark Maron.
That's right. And they radicalized him by showing him like something that was basically an homage to the parallax view about terrorist attacks. And, you know, so you had postal workers there near the time of anthrax. You had a theater takeover, which happened in Russia. I don't know if people remember that as well. Mm-hmm. All of this in there. And we did the movie, and I think it was a little bit of a mess.
Production issues.
We had production issues. It was hard. But there was a lot of different people. Like Colbert had like a little part in it. I think that ended up being on the cutting room floor. But I mean,
in the DVD extras available at your website.
And so we did this, and that's how I met Matthew. Ray Carney, who was a professor up at BU, one of Matthew's professors, had liked Who's the Caboose. I asked him if he knew any people. Sent me Matthew. Matthew was going to be my assistant.
He wasn't actually my professor, but we had a relationship anyway.
All right, well, there you go. And Matthew was going to be my assistant, and because I was directing and acting. And to make sure that he was always around me, I also put him in the movie as my character's assistant, so that he could carry around the notes for the directing and make it look like he was carrying around the character's notes. That was the way I rolled back in those days. And we did the movie 8 weeks into editing. It was 9/11. And
so inconvenient.
It was extremely inconvenient. There was the entity that had financed Requiem for a Dream was financing the post-production. I had financed the actual shooting from doing According to Jim, a sitcom. And they had never seen the script. And so they called me at one point. They said, is this going to impact your movie? Because they sort of knew the vague outlines. I'm like, oh, it could cut both ways. And it was impossible to even imagine how anybody could watch this film at that point. Like, because it was about the muting of dissent, and it was
barely possible before, and then now, exactly. Definitely.
It was a niche film prior to that. And
a certain dark sense of humor.
Yeah, they basically said, like, and I told them, I can't output it from the Avid until I pay the editor, who was not you at the time.
No, I remember.
And so they sent me, I think, like, you know, 10 grand and said, you can keep the money, just don't put our name on the film. So that's what happened. And it just sat for a couple of years until finally I said to Matthew, will you finish editing it? And then you did. And I think you did a very good job, all things considered.
Thank you, Sam. And I was very honored to resurrect such a work of love, a labor of love, and something so potentially offensive to so many Americans in the wake of such a tragedy.
Yes.
But guess what? It was funny. It was incisive. And it was one, I think, Bob Balaban casting away from being a classic.
Yes. I imagine like it ended up, I was trying to get Bob Balaban. He couldn't do it. And so we ended up getting Robert Schimmel. I almost had Charlie Rose in it until that last day. I mean, it's the story of the movie is much better than the movie, I think. But
still worth seeing and purchasing.
Pilotseasondvds.com. I'm not really trying to push it out that much.
Okay. But, I'll help you. I know. I can.
But and then Matthew, you had showed me a little short that you had made about 9/11, which was really also a little bit disturbing.
Can I just give us a little bit of background on that? That was actually commissioned by two filmmakers who I'm huge fans of and who I'd worked with subsequently, Kaveh Zahedi and Jay Rosenblatt. They made a compendium film called Underground Zero, where they reached out to a lot of independent and underground filmmakers to make short reactions to 9/11. And I decided to make one that was sort of, shall we say, a satirical look at the mass media fetishization of the impact over and over and over. It went down about as you could understand it might at a few festivals. And it didn't actually make the cut for their release, but I still urge people to go out and check out Underground Zero, a collection of really fine short films, not all of them funny, as you might imagine.
Yeah, I mean, yours was, and, you know, I just rewatched it yesterday, and it brought back how much they replayed those clips over and over. And in fact, for the first like 5 or 10 years, like, I don't know if MSNBC is going to do it tomorrow, but they for years not only replayed clips of it, they replayed the 2 hours of coverage, starting with the moment that the plane set. Like, they just ran it.
Yeah. It was that whole, you know, feedback loop. It looked like a movie, and then it sort of became a movie, and then it was on TV, and it was exploited for its sort of sensational value. It was a mind fuck, in a word.
It was, I mean, I, you know, and it's hard, you know, I think everybody experienced it obviously differently, you know, maybe to some extent where you are. I mean, right. Like, you know, how do you contextualize your experience of something like this? You know, I remember that entire morning very explicitly. I got up, got into the, was listening to Howard Stern. Somebody, Howard Stern was reporting that there was like a small plane that had landed into the Trade Center. They were like, you know, and they were sort of, no, like joking around about it, but they were, you know, it was like, oh, you know, that guy, blah, blah. And then as I got out of the shower, I think it was, somebody had called in and said, Howard, I saw, that was not a small plane. I saw one of the wheels, and it was a massive plane. It was like a 747. And then things started getting a little bit weird, and I went up onto the roof of my building, which was on 29th and Park South at that time. And I'm pretty sure I have video of the explosion of the second one coming out the, I've never looked at that tape again.
Oh, wow.
And came down, and my then at that time, my girlfriend, who then ultimately became my wife and then ultimately my ex-wife, she called me because she was on 7th Avenue. She lived right on 7th Avenue and heard the explosion, came up. John Benjamin, who lived down below Canal, within, you know, several blocks, came up because he was trying to get out of there. And then we went to went downtown at that night because it was Eric Slovin's birthday. Who is the executive director? He's the executive producer of what was it, of Broad City, right?
And he appears in Bad Situationist.
Yeah, and nobody else showed up at the party. It was just Benjamin and I, and I think Janine Garofalo were at the bar waiting. Like, where is everybody? And but then they cordoned off. You couldn't go below Houston Houston, I think it was. For weeks, unless you had proof that you lived down there. And I went down with Benjamin the next day on the 12th. We were on bikes, and there was like inches of ash everywhere, covering everywhere. We went into his apartment to get his stuff. You know, we had bandanas on, and it was a very bizarre time. You know,
it was insane. It was totally insane.
And I just had to explain it to Saul, who's 8. Like, I didn't get too graphic, but he didn't know what it was. And it's weird to me that, you know, we have people in the office who were like 5 at the time.
And get them out.
Huh? And so very crazy. I mean, I feel like on some level it impacted our politics and sort of our political culture more than it did like our artistic culture.
I mean, it impacted everything. You know, I even on that morning,
out, 15 years out, 20 years out.
I mean, listen, I think you can't separate it from the response that had, I think, an effect on our artistic culture. You know, the sort of the war on terror, the complete, you know, the hyper power sort of doubling down. All of that, I think, had an effect. And that was, if it was going to happen some other way, that was, I think, a major domino. And even on that, I remember when that even happened that morning, thinking, you know, I had seen enough dystopian sci-fi and read enough dystopian sort of future comic books and things that I realized that this event is going to, it's like where the mirror universe branches off, if you know what I'm saying. This is when the stuff starts to really become, you know, the mask is off and we're going to get the worst of human nature. And it's essentially what we did get. But I think, you know, a lot of popular culture and art reacted to that, not necessarily 9/11 per se, because it's, you know, it's one of these horrible things that it just defies sort of.
But where you know, do you
it,
see
it
that?
It defies critique. Huh?
Where do you see that in our art today?
Well, there's been a slew of movies that basically deal with it deliberately. But I also think that all the reaction to all of the things that came after it, you know, many, many filmmakers, I mean, some are more sensationalistic. You know, you had Greengrass's Flight 93 and Oliver Stone's World Trade Center. I mean, these are sort of the pop culture sort of,
yeah,
you
know, but
the spectacle
not
grinding it up.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but I don't know. I don't know if I can tell you exactly where it feels that way, because it's so pervasive. Like the whole post-war on terror world is so, you know, fraught with this idea that, you know, the United States is this, you know, global actor, and we're, you know, cultural imperialist, war, you know, materialist imperialist. So, you know, I don't know if I can necessarily tease that out for you directly. I'm trying to think of, you know, some filmmakers, you know, addressed it directly, and some people avoided it, you know, like the plague, basically.
But I'm talking about, like, you know, we had Spencer Ackerman on the other day, and his book makes the argument that, like, you can track these things in sort of like our political culture,
mm-hmm.
and in our, you know, that the way that 9/11 turned into a justification for demonizing Muslims ended up being sort of like the bridge that reinvigorated, or that's a mixed metaphor there, I guess, but the became sort of like an accelerant or the catalyst to reignite or, you know, inflame this sort of like ongoing, you know, theme of race that we've had in this country, obviously, since its founding. And I try and think about, like, you know, irony was not dead after that.
But it did take a nap for a little bit.
Did it, though? Maybe.
At least for a few months.
I mean, I'm just trying to think, like, what's interesting is that there was no, you know, comedy didn't become political at all during that time. I see it from, you know, from the perspective of somebody who was in comedy at that time. Like, you know, the idea that Janine and I would go into politics was completely absurd to people. Now, people are a lot more political.
Little absurd. No, you're right. Not absurd.
But now comedians are much more political, right? I mean, now it seems like art is much more political now than it was in the 5 years after 9/11.
I don't know. You'd have to give me some examples, because I feel like it's always been that same thing. You know, there's that little thin line of people who are being political, overtly political, and then there's entertainers. It's not necessarily, I don't know if it got any more or less. I mean, you know, you have some musical responses, but unfortunately, I feel like the worst effect of it is that, you know, to quote Guy Debord, the spectacle just absorbed that all that stuff. So now we have like action movies like you know, Cloverfield or the Greengrass movie that basically used the resonance of that moment just to make entertainment. So I'm struggling to think of a great example of how that is true, Sam.
Yeah,
that people became more political. I mean, listen, I went on the Iraq War March. I did, you know, all that stuff that bounced.
People didn't become more political. That was sort of the weird thing about it.
It's because listen, we're in late stage, you know, spectacle triumphant. Like it's become harder and harder. And this is what you work towards this every day, is trying to reinstill a sense of collective possibility and a sense of actual of people as individuals having an effect on their society. You know, I think art does have that possible power, but I think it's much more subtle and it's much more personal than, you know, on an overt political level. At least that's what I concern myself with. But I don't know which comedians. I mean, you had you know, you had like the right-wing comedians, you had like the blue collar comedy and all that stuff. They had all that sort of punching down.
Who? Dennis Miller.
Yeah. You had the sort of reactionary.
This comes up every now and then. It hasn't come up in a couple of years, but I want people to understand this. I have a Dennis Miller doll in this office.
I know. I sold a few on eBay. Remember?
And like literally it would say stuff about, I don't know if it's around anymore. You could press the button and it would talk. And it would say stuff. It would like mock the French because they were hesitant to attack Iraq. But this is how
Palestinian jokes.
Is there a better? Yeah, exactly. Is there a better example of how dystopian things were after 9/11 that Dennis Miller was elevated to some type of right wing hero so much so that they literally made an action figure with him? And the dolls that were available: Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush, the Pope, Ann Coulter, and Dennis Miller. I kid you not.
I mean, look at all the other pop culture things that came out, like what's the with the Kiefer Sutherland terrorism show,
right? 24.
The machine just kept churning. Actually, I think the best humor.
I guess the culture just sort of actually, to the extent that you could measure the culture got more right wing.
That's how I see it. I mean, I feel like it's been on a trajectory ever since the 60s, a sort of cultural, you know, pendulum. I hope this generation moves it back the other way. I hope we get some of that stuff. But
I think that is happening. Don't you, though?
I don't know, Sam. You're much more in touch with the pulse of the youth of today. You tell me.
I mean, I know you're being facetious, but I'm saying, like, I definitely think so. I mean, I think that the culture is... I don't necessarily know if I would. Look at the shows that we have, you know, like, I don't know, Succession or, what was that? White Lotus. White Lotus.
Or like I hear that's very good.
The Bo Burnham new stand up comedy special, which is kind of just sounds, I haven't watched it, but it sounds like him just going on political rants, talking about neoliberalism and stuff.
Oh,
like that.
There's a ton of that, though. There's a ton of politicization. I think part of that was maybe Trump, but I think part of it was also sort of like some type of backlash and sort of feeling that, you know, maybe Obama didn't, you know, provide the sort of regeneration that he was supposed to.
I'm also thinking of our favorite show, Battlestar Galactica. They took a lot of pains to instill a sort of, it was much, again, it was that secondary thing that Iraq basically was its impetus.
That's right, actually. And that was quite early.
But see, this is the problem I always run into with these things. It's like, if it's popular entertainment or it's art, right, and you're trying to instill this sort of political message, to what extent does the political message have to become so neutered and so sort of basic that it doesn't have any effect after a while? Is it worse to give the impression that you're getting a political message, so you go back to bed and you say, oh, I'm woke, I know what's up, and then it doesn't actually affect any change? You know, that's the tricky line you have to walk.
There's this reality show that's like, who's going to be the next great American activist or something like that? And it's going to be judged by like a panel of...
CBS. Yeah. I mean, Jesus. Somebody just said I-5. Comedy didn't become political after 9/11. Of course it did. You remember borderline fascist and racist like the media. I remember Ahmed the Dead Terrorist. I mean, that's actually right. Actually.
Puppet guy. That's
We had those two gray, Parker, those two libertarians who did South Park. They did that, America thing that, you know, blew up Janine
and America,
Team America, which was, right wing Jeff Dunham. Yeah, no, now that I think about it, I guess maybe I blocked it out because the culture had actually become much more right wing.
Sad, but true. I mean, look, the real artists are always going to be on the margins, always doing something that the popular culture isn't ready for. That never changes, really. Eventually, sometimes they move into the center and are feted and are appreciated, sometimes that way after their deaths. So I don't think we should expect anything else. It's on us to go digging if we're so motivated. And, you know, come join my film appreciation class and I'll show you multiple films where... hopefully something of value is being said that is not on the mainstream radar.
Well, well, that's
I actually. Well, I just want to say what the main joke I recall was at some point I was shooting videos for Todd Barry and Benjamin and Cross's Tinkle, and they were discussing how they were going to go give I think a Entertainment Nightlife Award or something to Todd Barry. I don't know if you were at this, but they were discussing their speech, and they decided that they were going to go up and just say, this was like 2 years later. On the morning of September 11th, our world was changed forever. And the award for best comedian for the nightlife of 2003 is Todd Barry. Yeah. Just to me is a perfect way. Cause what do you, how do you, there's like, you just, you have to just recognize that we can laugh at it. Otherwise you'll go completely insane. And I definitely, another thing I want to mention about that morning is that I got a call from my father. I was woken up by my roommate when the second plane hit. He's like, this is some real stuff. So what was that? Like 9 something, much too early for me to normally get up. But we turned on the TV and it was just like insanity. And I got a call from my father. And he said to me on that same day, like literally Osama bin Laden. So it was already in the zeitgeist that, you know, the Muslim terrorists, the Islamic terrorists were, you know, it's like the story was already there. You know, we had the USS Cole. We obviously had the bombing in 93. But
people thought the Oklahoma federal building, the first thing right. people to do was Islamic terrorism.
So I'm just saying it already fit into a, you know, we already had our lens of looking at it. It just so happens it possibly was, Islamic terrorism. I say possibly because I don't want to get added by the loose change people, but it was just so obvious to even the sort of cursorily invested people in politics. It just was a hard, I don't know. It just speaks to the state of where people were at even then before that. When you're talking about where the culture was going.
Yeah. Yeah, it just didn't seem as it didn't seem as prominent. But yes, there was that narrative was there.
And I didn't personally go down below Canal Street for I think like 5 years. Honestly, I think even when I went to Zuccotti Park in 2011, it was the first time I had really like been down there because of how because I was at the time temping right near there at the American Express building, so I could have been there. At that time doing some office work, you know.
That building had a lot of shattered glass, and in fact that's I think where one of the principals from that that film company that was providing me the funds, they lived like
right. Oh really?
Building, yeah.
I didn't know that. Anyway, it should
have you ever been to the 9/11 memorial?
Since then I've actually been a part of sort of a corporate events that like bring people in and that part of the tour, you know, that you because you recall the idea that like people in Times Square asking you which way to 9/11?
Oh,
how
right.
do I get to 9/11? Yes. You know, it's achieved that status. So I've been to some of those down there, and quite frankly, it creeps me out. I had to get out of town. I went out of town with some friends very shortly thereafter. Thankfully, they had a place upstate, so I didn't come back for I don't know a week that I can recall.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's a little bit tough. I do remember at one point the biggest shift for me was I had been arguing with NBC about beat cops, and they're like, they may want to shoot it up in Canada, and I'm like, Canada? It's about two New York City police officers on the street. Like literally, the whole thing was shot on the street. You can't go to Toronto. And then they called in like October, and they're like, they want to shoot in Toronto. And I'm like, you got it.
Yeah.
Shoot up.
It was good enough for Jackie Chan to do Rumble in the Bronx there. It's good enough for Sam Cedar and Beat Cops.
All right. So do you got something for us that harkens to 9/11, or did you forget that tomorrow is 9/11?
Oh, is it tomorrow? Actually, I did want to say one thing. Just as a side note before I get to that, The guy who, the filmmaker who did the Underground Zero film collection, his name's Kaveh Zahedi. Are you familiar with him? I don't know if you ever met him. He's another guy that I know through Ray Carney. He's a fan of his work. No? I worked on his film, I Am a Sex Addict. And I think in the past I recommended his show called The Show About the Show, which every episode is about the making of the previous episode. And he sort of mines his own personal life extremely honestly to make this sort of recursive autobiographical show.
That sounds great.
It's incredible. It also ruined his marriage, which was probably on the rocks anyway, but it's all in the film. It's all in the show. So right now he's doing a Kickstarter to get the fourth season, actually the third season, which the fourth season is going to be about the third season, funded. And he's only about $2,000 away. So I want to urge people to go to Kaveh Zahedi on Twitter. And he's actually doing a telethon tomorrow featuring a ton of really great people from Rick Linkletter, Will Oldham, a lot of the people he's worked with in the past, filmmakers and artists who are doing like a sort of Jerry Lewis style telethon to get him over the edge for his Kickstarter. And I just want to boost the signal on that a little bit. Kaveh Zahedi, Z-A-H-E-D-I. And his first name's Kaveh, C-A-V-E-H. But anyway,
great guy, descriptions.
A willing subject to mine his life, his personal life. And it's the show is, it's like you can't look away. It's so compelling. And he believes in radical honesty, total honesty. And I believe that is what led to his divorce. But this is,
Is that covered in the show?
Oh, yes, it is.
Interesting.
Very, very much so. And sometimes when he couldn't get people to like recreate what happened, he would hire actors to play them. So at a certain point, his wife decided she's not going to be in it anymore. So he got an actress to play his wife.
You've got
to see it. It's extremely unique and extremely compelling. The guy's a genius.
I guess once you go through the divorce, if it causes the divorce, you're at that point, like, I gotta keep doing this show. Like the sunk costs are just too high.
Basically, yeah. But all of his films, his whole life has been very autobiographical. So it's sort of just like the apotheosis of his sort of style. But in any case, I just wanted to plug that real quick for him. So the movie that I actually want to pick today is actually something that he reminded me of. He just came out with an article. He's doing a lot of press for this fundraiser. And he listed some of his favorite films. And it's also one of my favorite films. And it's called Wax, or The Discovery of Television Among the Bees. And it's an early 90s shot on basically analog video using some of the very early, I want to say not video toaster, slightly more professional, but like video effects. And it is a mind-bending kind of trip of a film about the sort of, the liminal world, the world of the dead, mixed with a lot of military-industrial complex. He's like a designer of targeting systems for weapons, but the bees start to talk to him, and he's channeling the spirit of his dead grandfather who gave him the bees. It defies a description. It is one of the most unique films ever made, and it is actually available. The filmmaker's name is David Blair. It's actually available for free on his website, along with, which I haven't seen yet, his sequel miniseries, I guess, and it's at waxweb.org. But if anybody's wants to check that out, I can't recommend it any more highly. It's definitely a just give into it, let it rewire your brain. Just take off. It's got so many different threads, so many different themes. The visuals are extremely creative. It's sort of almost got an experimental film quality to it, even though it's sort of this narrative, this very personal voiceover driven narrative film. But it's unheralded as to the extent that people know about it. But it is definitely, I think, a masterpiece. Wait. Wax.
I'm at Wax Web, and it says episode 0, and it looks like it's 26 minutes long. Is that what I'm looking at?
Yeah, no, that is the, I'll send you the link. It's on his Vimeo page too. If you go to David Blair's Vimeo, hit that link. That's, I think, the beginning of the mini series. But I'll send you the link to the film itself. It's either on his Vimeo page or it's on YouTube. I can't remember where exactly it lives now. But the feature film, it's like, you know, a 90-minute film. Then you can go look at all those other things afterwards. I highly recommend.
Okay, great. Yeah, send me the link for that, and we'll also put the link for Zahedi. Is that it?
Kaveh Zahedi, yeah.
Kaveh Zahedi.
And And I would be remiss if I didn't tell people to go check me out on Letterboxd, where you can follow along with all the movies that I've been watching. I've been on vacation this week, so I haven't seen a lot of movies over this past week. Mary and I went up to Lake George, which was a nice time to be there, except for that our apartment got rained on over the storm. But
sorry to hear that.
That's okay. We're dealing. But yeah, you can follow me on Letterboxd. I love talking to people also on the Discord in the movies room, the Majority Report Discord. Lovely group of people in there, always willing to chat up some films and TV. I was asked to discuss Columbo by a member of the group today. So I just want to give a shout out to Detective Columbo and suggest that we change.
Why? Because Peter Falk and Cassavetes, or was it just a random thing?
I think it's a random thing. These things have a life of their
own. Columbo on Peacock, I think, is why, to be honest with you. I heard that. I met Peter Falk in an elevator in New York City when I was like 5 or 7. 7, I think it was, or 10. I used to watch Columbo as a kid, and so I knew who he was, and I was pretty exciting.
That is exciting. Did you ask him? Did you talk to him, or was it just like, there he is?
I said, hi. And he said, hi. That was it.
That's something that he said.
Yeah, you know, you don't want to find out too much about your heroes, you know, like what we were saying. So,
yeah, no, but as obviously, yes, his work with Cassavetes is my main love of him, and Mikey and Nikki, which is probably my all time favorite movie. But, you know, Columbo, he knew what he was doing, and he hired all his friends, too. You can see all these episodes with Bizarra and Cassavetes and Jenna Rollins. They all showed up there. So anyway, and as long as are you playing me off? Because I do want to say one other thing.
Go ahead.
Which is that my film appreciation class, which you can go to my Twitter at Langdon Boom and see that it's signing up now. It starts October 5th, and it's going to be 10 films that we show, one a week. And then we have an online Zoom discussion. The group of people who join are really intelligent, really insightful. We have great discussions. And for Majority Report listeners, I was able to get the member rate. Wait for it. You can do it. No? Okay. The member rate, which is if you're not a member of the Common Point Queens Community Center, you usually pay $10 extra for the class per class or some amount. But for Majority Report listeners, you can have the membership rate by just mentioning that you heard about it on the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. Indeed. Just sign up as normal, and the director of the program will contact you and give you your discount.
Good stuff.
And so we look forward to seeing everybody there. You may or may not see one of the Cedar sisters or both of them. They have been past members of the class, and a lot of other cool people through the Majority Report family have been there too. So looking forward to seeing you all there shortly.
Matthew Film Guy, much appreciated.
My pleasure, Sam.
Thanks, Matt.
See you next time.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Let's see. We go Freebie Friday? Yeah, I think we will. We'll go Freebie Friday today. Because we got about another 40 minutes of the program today. Don't forget, you can support this show by becoming a member. You go to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show, you get the fun half, too. Although today it is a Freebie Friday. And that doesn't happen every Friday, incidentally. I'm trying to make them scarce. But also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And we have our newsletter. Head over to majority.fm, scroll all the way down to the bottom, put your email in. We send you the AM quickie every morning. Corey and Jack alternate, more or less. And send you top headlines, a little bit of analysis, and some stuff maybe that you missed on the show. It is a great read. People are loving it. Check it out. And also, of course, the Discord, majoritydiscord.com. Let's get into some of this. This is, you know, we were talking about, this is just like, we're talking about this with Ryan Grimm earlier. Right now, the Republicans have gone all in on the anti-mask mandates, and they are sending people out to school board meetings. It is reminiscent of the Tea Party going to the healthcare town halls, and there is no doubt it is motivating a lot of these lunatics to get out, and they're going to vote. But I also think that it is also sort of like making people aware that they are lunatics. This kid, Grady Hunt, he's a teenager in Rutherford County, Tennessee. Remember, was it a month ago? We played some clips of like parents who were like yelling at people who had come in and testified to a school board meeting that, like, you know, you should have masks because it saves lives. Grady Hunt, teenager. He is up. He is at the school board meeting talking in favor of a mask. And listen to what happens. He's talking in favor of masks because someone close to him died.
Watch the woman behind him.
It's just unbelievable. Here it is.
Additionally, I'm worried about my family. If I get COVID, I'm going to bring it to my family. And I talk to my grandparents a lot. They're higher risk than me, so I don't want to give them COVID. This time last year, my grandmother, who was a former teacher at the Rutherford County School System, died of COVID because someone wasn't wearing a mask.
Hey guys, we're here to act professional. Please, sir, go ahead.
Thank you. This is an avoidable issue. And by not wearing masks in schools, it's irresponsible. We're killing people. This is not something that we should be doing for the education of our students.
You can see the video produced by Newsweek there. I guess they're just pulling it from a... you got people laughing at this guy. And women just like, oh, this kid. She said his grandmother died.
Yeah, I mean, they're laughing because they think, no, she didn't die because of, I guess, a mask. But, like, how do you know?
I mean, yeah, aside from all the data that suggests that masks offer protection. Not total protection, some protection. I mean,
if my grandma was around somebody who was unvaccinated and was not wearing a mask and infected her with COVID, I would also say that they killed her for not wearing a mask.
Yeah, it is. But like how? And then the guy's like, oh, we're all trying to be professional here. No, actually, the baseline is just be human.
But you just like look at the way that the women roll their eyes behind him.
Yeah.
Like he says, like, I mean, just resenting that he's worried about people getting the disease.
What did they think was going to happen at this meeting, too? I wasn't prepared for somebody to come up there and talk about how masks were important at this meeting and about how somebody had died. That's not fair. This is pretty good. And, you know, again, Ryan Grimm made the point that it would be great if we saw on... not just MSNBC, CNN, Fox, you're not going to see it, but all the other news outlets. But certainly you would imagine MSNBC, this would be pretty good territory for them to talk about the real conflict of interests that Joe Manchin has. That it's not an ideological thing. He doesn't care about the deficit. It's really he wants to make sure that there's lowered taxes, and he doesn't want there to be any type of hampering of the business prospects of coal or, let's say, pharmaceuticals. At the very least, we get Katie Porter on with Stephanie Ruhle calling out Joe Manchin and other so-called centrist Democrats.
Using a real corporate profit approach to dealing with those corporations that pay zero, we could generate $700 billion. If we use the corporate minimum tax approach, we're going to generate $40 billion. Right there, Senator Manchin, right there, anyone who's worried about spending, we can generate the revenue so that this isn't about $3.5 trillion in spending. It's not even now about $3.5 trillion in spending because we're going to generate the revenue to pay for these things. I have the will to do it. The question is, does Senator Manchin, or is he more concerned about his corporate donors, including large corporations, the oil and gas industry, the big pharmaceutical industry, and others who are getting away with paying nothing under our current tax system?
So in other words, what we're seeing here is just like they're calling a Manchin's bluff. If you're really worried about the deficit, let's raise some taxes. But of course, this is exactly what Manchin wants to avoid, is raising taxes. He doesn't care about the spending side. It's just a, it is just a mechanism in which to deflect from the fact that he's trying to avoid raising taxes on wealthy people, on corporations, on industries that he's associated with. I mean, that's basically it. Bottom line, we don't need the revenue from taxes to pay for these things. We have the ability to literally print money. But there's a lot of value in taxing these entities and wealthy people for the sake of income inequality, of wealth inequality in this country. And if it has the added bonus of putting Joe Manchin in a tight spot, more power to those revenue raisers. Let's go to the IMs. Sam, get Douglas Rushkoff on the program. Dude is brilliant and can help shed light on a lot of portions of our day. Sam Massachusetts asked Matthew Film Guy if he saw the Bourdain doc. Sorry if a guy didn't do that. I'm at your service, Sam. Maybe that with the success of Suns Out, Guns Out fundraising campaign, we could convince Sam to do more things that make him uncomfortable on the live show. How about a fun half where Sam receives a full body massage, complete with scented oils and soothing music? That actually, honestly, is like one of my worst nightmares. The idea of getting like a stranger to give me a massage with scented oils. That doesn't get any more disturbing for me. It's always snowy in Ottawa. I know you and Ryan Grimm have actually important things to talk about. However, if Ryan stays to the fun half, I think it would be fun Friday to talk about how he used debate Sam Cedar when Jimmy Sora was getting up, but he's saying Ryan was dodging his offer to debate on the show. Fletch Nasty, Sam, humorous story for Casual Friday. Had an encounter with a guy who said to me, I don't trust the vaccine because I still continue to take precautions despite being vaxxed. It just reminded me of a story a friend told me about my old football teammates. The story goes, the team had just gotten new helmets, so the guy decided to put them to the test, exclaiming helmet check as he headbutt a locker room support beam full force. He immediately got a concussion to the surprise of nobody. He's fine now, except he doesn't remember what happened. The moral of the story is just because something is supposed to protect you doesn't mean it always will. Happy Friday, MR crew. Clown Shoe Mike, that reply to Starnes on Twitter was hilarious. Cower with Crowder. How has no journalist responded to Tucker Carlson's what is your favorite sexual position for asking personal questions with whatever position your mom is in? Militant apathy. Hate to say it, but I don't think Obama would have had the minerals to do what Biden did. It's all so ridiculous, you can't even get to go to pre-K without shots. Now you've got Dan Dumbass Crenshaw saying a mandate will start a civil war. Dude was in the effing military. They don't give you a choice. They line your ass up first day of basic training and they give you a ton of shots. Whether you want it or not, he's still full of it. Nerd Cheetah. Just want to let you know I appreciate you recognizing out loud that public schools and public education often get scapegoated in times of national crisis. Been an elementary teacher in New York for 20 plus years and this current boots on the ground perspective, CDC and New York SED guidelines are cover your A. BS that's 100% behind keeping kids in school first, saving lives, is a side deal. Lefter is better, pardon the grammar. Desert Bialsh, 58. Yeah, Dem voters are out there that don't support vaccines and the mandates. I can't with them. Ricardo Lazarus. Hey, Sam, Portugal is now reaching 80% vaccination rate. We did a huge spike with Delta at the beginning of the summer, but as vaccination advances, the numbers keep going down, despite the country being mostly open for 6 weeks now. The vaccination seems to be really working against Delta. There was a study that came out with three states. Washington State was one of them. That just came out from data in July that show being vaccinated significantly diminishes your chance of getting COVID significantly. It greatly diminishes your chance of getting it seriously. Bear, can I please get a shofar for my significant other? It's our one-year anniversary, not university. She is a leftist organizer who continually fights for justice. She's the first person with my politics, to be honest, better politics, that I've ever dated, and she inspires. Her biggest disagreement is she doesn't like your libertarian debates because she thinks the libertarians are so stupid they're not even worth laughing over. Fair enough, because libertarians are stupid. This goes out to her. Sounds great, except for her misunderstanding about the value of those libertarian debates.
Yeah, I mean, women have a greater immunity towards libertarianism. I think
that's true. I think that's true. Just have, like, I am being logical. Therefore, I am ascendant.
No, it's not really for them because they're less of a risk than some of the men are.
Yeah, I think so. And the men feel like it's super empowering. Like there's like a mansplain. There's some type of like mansplain virus that when it hits libertarianism, like it creates some type of uber force. This is logical. This will allow me to correct everyone as long as I don't actually engage. Ezard, remandate. I believe we're worried about SCOTUS dismantling the administrative state. Is this a mandate, a place for that to begin? I don't know how you could, there's plenty of, there's I don't know, 115-year-old case. I can't remember what it was that said the government has the right to mandate stuff like this. Door knocker. Will Biden's vaccine ultimatum also apply to school districts with more than 100 people on staff? No. Private companies and federal employees. That's my belief. Warren from Toronto. Hi, Sam. As you know, we have an election here in about 10 days. I agree with Ryan. There might be a liberal contingent that won't vote for Trudeau or will vote for the Conservative Party because of vaccine mandates. Anecdotally, I've talked to people who are not going to vote liberal because of them, which is surprising because my district is consistently liberal federally. How large that contingent is, I don't know, but considering where Trudeau is in the poll and comparably Newsom, 2 to 4% is all that's needed to give the election to a conservative. Theorist, the step-up basis has always been tied to the notion that gift tax and estate tax are a combined system. It's only because of exemptions and exemption levels applicable to gift estate taxes that the step-up basis would not be fully justified. Upon the relevant transfer of ownership, a tax would be due, whether during the transfer, its life, or upon death, and paid out for the proceeds of the transfer. Therefore, you would give a step-up in basis to reflect that taxes were or are already paid when the transfer at that present value took place. I'm sorry. I need that to be like drawn out for me. Mutz Butts, Joe Manchin's daughter, sounds like the title of a Pearl Jam song. Mark O'Brien, something to look out. My county, Collin County in North Dallas, leans slightly Republican and is much more vaccinated than Dallas County, which is heavily leans Den. After doing a lot of research, I discovered there's less of a political discrepancy and more of an education one. College-educated people, regardless of race and political party, are much more vaccinated than non-college-educated people by a lot. Well, okay, now it's very difficult though to assess why that is, right? Because non-college educated people are probably working at a job that is more likely to be hourly. They are more likely to have a greater imbalance in power between them and their employers. They are more likely to not have the opportunity to take a day or two off because they're sick. And so it may be tied into education level, but it also could be that education level is a proxy for power in the workplace. Look, there's at least 30 million people out there, according to a poll I saw recently, who they're not hesitant of the vaccine as much as they are hesitant of the process because they can't get time off from work or whatnot. This mandate should hopefully in some way implicate that. We're going to take a quick break. I'm going to be back in 30 seconds. Quick break. Sorry about that. Quick little break. Maybe we can cut that out of the. We should probably play a little bit of music. This is an oldie but a goodie. I wonder what motivates Fox News for bringing out Sarah Palin. Like, how does that happen? Do you think she's
there
out
should
there?
Be some sort of protocols written up at Fox News. This
exactly.
is when we go to the Sarah Palin thing.
Like, what do you think that maybe she's just like what do you think is happening there? Does she have a PR person that says, like, do you want Palin on for this? And they're like, it's been a while, I guess. Or is she in New York? Or it just seems so weird. I'm not quite clear. Here is the former Alaska governor, also former reality star, also former Dancing with the Stars, or what? No, singing. What was she? Wasn't she the mystery singer?
Masked Singer.
What was it?
The Masked Singer.
Masked Singer. She did not quit those two last things. She quit the governorship, incidentally, just to remind you. And she was also John McCain's vice presidential nominee. Yeah. That John McCain. Here she is on Fox News, and maybe they're just trying to figure out, like, how can we attack AOC?
Yeah.
Wow, AOC, she's really milking this, isn't it? She is such a fake feminist that she would bring up an issue like this and try to use it to make some kind of political point. That's not it. That's not equality, right? It's, oh man, don't even get me started on this. This just makes my stomach sick what she has done. She should be embarrassed to even have tried to bring up an issue like that.
I want to remind people, okay, so she was basically saying that, you know, Abbott is not a menstruating person. So has no sense of, like, what, you know, this abortion ban or, you know, what 6 weeks constitutes. Incidentally, the whole heartbeat provision, turns out that's not a heartbeat. There is no heart. It's an embryo at 6 weeks. It's not even a fetus yet. It doesn't have a heart. There are electrical currents that run through it. And there's a machine that translates those electrical currents into a thumping sound. It is not like you put a stethoscope on there. You would not hear the embryo heart beating because there's no heart. It has not developed yet. So go back to the beginning, just with that context. And here's Sarah Palin. She's the true feminist. And so this is like... This is for those people who watch Fox who want to make sure that they're inoculated from saying that you're a misogynist, and because they can look at and crap all over AOC and say, like, I'm not a misogynist. I'm a feminist. Just that's why I love Sarah Palin so much.
Wow, AOC, she's really milking this, isn't it? She is such a fake feminist that she would bring up an issue like this and try to use it to make some kind of political point. That's not it. That's not equality, right? It's, oh man, don't even get me started on this. This just makes my stomach sick what she has done. She should be embarrassed to even have tried to bring up an issue like that and make her political point. She's so off base politically, but off base even in this analogy or whatever it is that she's throwing out there. She's milking the whole female thing. And as a real feminist, I'm embarrassed for her.
Why? You know, I get, where did the idea of milking something come from?
Yeah, she got the, she said like the same thing, but like same, like three things over and over again.
Let's just be clear here. Sarah Palin's been out of politics for 11 years. Sarah Palin, were it not for her being chosen by John McCain, who was afraid of some type of essentially revolt at the Republican National Convention, Sarah Palin would just be barely a footnote. So when we talk about milking...
Milking the whole female thing.
Milking the female thing. Milking the... I mean, she's been milking that nomination to vice presidency for 13 years. More. That's a... That is a... That is one... One, like, full udder of milk to have been milked for that long.
It's hard to watch someone struggle to speak that much, too. Like, she knows she can't, she's not saying anything at all.
She's
milking this whole feminist thing, and as a fake feminist, I just think it's bad that she would try to use this issue to make a political point, and that's not quality. What do you, what?
Let's just play this one more time, because it's always fun to listen to the words out.
Wow, AOC, she's really milking this, isn't it? She is such a fake feminist that she would bring up an issue like this and try to use it to make some kind of political point. That's not it. That's not equality, right? It's, oh, man, don't even get me started on this. This just makes my stomach sick what she has done. She should be embarrassed to even have tried to bring up an issue like that and make her political point. She's so off base politically, but off base even in this analogy or whatever it is that she's throwing out there. She's milking the whole female thing. And as a real feminist, I'm embarrassed for her.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who occasionally talks on a microphone, I'm embarrassed for Sarah Palin. Because she's let me be done talking.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah, fill the space. I'm getting paid for this, right? I wonder if she gets paid. I really wonder what the heck that's about. So as you know, there was a statue of a Confederate General Robert E. Lee was taken down. Where exactly was it?
Sure. Oh, was it Richmond? I thought, okay.
But where in Richmond? Was it at the State House? Or just, is it in just sort of some type of like a generic location in Richmond, Virginia? Look, if you live in New York, every day.
It's a Charlottesville, Virginia's Market Street Park.
Sure. Okay. Charlottesville, Virginia. If you live in New York every day, not every day, but many days, you walk through New York City. And you see that they have destroyed history, and they have replaced it. They've replaced it with another building. The change in New York City over the past 25 years has been extraordinary. Buildings that were there for 100 years, more, torn down, replaced with, frankly, in my opinion, very often less attractive buildings. Much less character, no history, Just here around the corner from where we are, there's still only one building left that was associated with the Underground Railroad. And then and buildings that were right next to it were, you know, replaced it with like some crappy hotel, prefab building. That's what happens in a society. Does it happen with statues? Of course, all the time. People become less relevant, or society starts to question like the premise behind why is this symbol important for us to go by? Why was it here in the first place? Why is it, what is it relevant today? And is it in fact wrong today? I don't know when this particular statue was put up, but if I had to guess, it was between the 1907 and 1925.
The statue was commissioned in 1917 and dedicated in 1924.
So, and how do I know that? Is simply because this was the pushback following Reconstruction, where there was an attempt by white people to reassert and reinterpret the Confederacy. And meanwhile, who better to comment on this type of thing than the Pope of the Jews, Ben Shapiro? Here it is.
So my view is that the statue should remain, and we should discuss the statue in all of its complexity and all of its nuance. Okay, however, that's really not my issue here. My issue is what we replace things with, what we replace American history with, what we replace that discussion with, what we have decided to replace the discussion of American history with.
Pause it. Statues are not history.
They're a discussion in a sort of way.
The statues are not history. They are assertions. They are attempts to define what history was. History exists outside of statues. And in this instance, that statue was in fact a way to obscure the history of the United States. It was obscuring it. It was obscuring history, and it was an attempt to impose a reality and a future that was based on an ideology. Statues are ideological. They are not reflections of history. They are attempts to remind people of certain things that happened in the past and in certain ways that reflect society's values or how people want society's values to be. They're not history. And if you're talking about like, well, but they're conversation starters, there's a lot of different ways you can start the conversation of the Civil War. But continue.
So my view is that the statue should remain, and we should discuss the statue in all of its complexity and all of its nuance. Okay, however, that's really not my issue here. My issue is what we replace things with, what we replace American history with, what we replace that discussion with, and what we have decided to replace the discussion of American history with, what we have decided to replace our own history with, is a perverse, simplified wokeness that does spell the end of America in pretty much all of its forms. Not the getting rid of the Robert E. Lee statue per se, but what we are replacing it with. And what I mean here is that there was a time capsule that was buried under the Robert E. Lee statue in the base of the statue. We are now replacing it. Okay, this is the part that's kind of astonishing. And also, the imagery that was associated with the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue. Right? If you are going to remove the iconography of the past, it should be done in a sort of, I would say, solemn fashion. It should be done very seriously. Instead, the Robert E. Lee statue was removed to the wild celebration of a crowd below, as though they were toppling a statue of Saddam Hussein or something. Robert E. Lee does not preside over the country, nor did he ever preside over the country per se, right? He was the general of the Confederacy was defeated between 1861 and 1865. And you saw one of the people who was taking this thing down, who'd been tasked with taking this down, putting up the Black Lives Matter fist as this was taken down. Now, you can say that maybe the statue should be taken down, but replacing it with the ideology of Black Lives Matter, which is that America is invariably racist, not only conflicts with the actual imagery, which is a black man taking down a statue of a Confederate general, which does not bespeak the white supremacy of the United States in 2021, but also Black Lives Matter is pushed and based on a lie. The lie that black Americans are immutably stricken by the American systems of power. That it's the same sort of rationale as critical race theory, Black Lives Matter. And if you're a black person in America, you live with the boot of America on your throat all day long. That obviously is not true. I mean, we're literally taking down statues right now, right, that offend people. But that sort of imagery is telling.
First off, I can't. This feels like one of those days where it's like, I didn't do my homework and I'm coming in and I'm just rambling. He is arguing that the fact that there is a guy giving the Black Power sign is an indication of that we are not immutably subject to white supremacy, which I would agree is the case. But in fact, it is achieving exactly what you say you're implying should be achieved and can be achieved in America. Well, this is it, man. It's happening. Like, and it's, is the job done? No. But we're doing a little bit of cleanup right now.
It's funny that he brings up the Saddam instance himself, because that's exactly what these things are. Like,
totally.
These are just like really old Saddam statues, except to Confederates.
Exactly. Exactly. And, taking it down is in fact a small, tiny step towards both acknowledging that the values that raised that statue were wrong, that the statue's continued existence imparts values that we as a society have evolved past. We haven't necessarily reached a full evolvement yet. And then, you know, like I saw somebody on Twitter, I can't remember which right winger it was, like, name one policy that's improved from this. You know what? Give me another 10 or 15 years. And maybe we'll start to see some policies when people don't walk by a statue and think like, oh, what could have been wrong about the Confederacy that we would venerate the guy who led it?
I think that this conversation is developing to the point that we're starting to remove these things actually is a sign of like this sort of policy improving society somewhat.
And here he is going like, BLM says that America is immutably oppressing black people. Well, dude, no. Actually, when we take those statues down, we're showing that there is at least a tiny bit of mutability. And it also expresses the idea that like there's more mutability that can be had. And so, in fact, no, if BLM's ideology was that America is immutable, they wouldn't be doing this.
Yeah. And it's not about essences. It's about systems.
Exactly. And the idea that America is unchangeably white supremacist society would mean that there was absolutely no point to take down the statue.
Right.
And no point. Yeah. To protest
that it's invariably white supremacists. Yeah, actually, if you look at most historians of race, they outline that actually racism has gotten worse, particularly as capitalism developed as a rationale to, you know, justify taking from people and forcing them to do labor.
And we can see that there is an ebb and flow. That's why I can guess without any basis other than just knowing our history when that statue went up.
They'd rather turn it into like that sort of philosophical about immutable oppression rather than just a historical one about who put this up and for what.
Exactly. It just sounds to me like he hadn't done his homework that day and was just trying to come up with something. Is there anything more to that? That's it, right? Lastly, speaking about not doing any of your homework. So apparently Steven Crowder is still alive. He made it through his rebounding from our non-debate. Fine. And how do you rebound from that? When you've got to, let's just understand that, like, Crowder is, there's, you know, he understands the YouTube business, streaming business, in a way that I think I may never understand, right? And I will say, like, you know, my experience with that whole debate scenario where Ethan Klein brought me on, Ethan Klein understands that business too, because we were supposed to go on I was supposed to crash that debate, and the debate was supposed to happen a week before it ultimately did. Crowder canceled at the last minute because we had ended our show early. And Ethan was like, he's watching your show because he's afraid that you're going to actually come on in this thing. And remember that when he said that to us? And I'm like, no way, dude. That can't be. That would be nuts. And then, in fact, Crowder admitted it during the debate.
So, in an attempt to own you somehow.
Well, yeah, he understood the mechanisms much more than he could actually sort of break it down and react to it.
Yeah.
But my point is, when he comes back from his vacation or, you know, his medical treatment to deal with a bruised ego, he looks at his numbers and they're down. When we take a vacation, the numbers go down. So Crowder's saying to himself, how am I going to raise my numbers? How am I going to get my people back? Oh, I know.
In-depth policy analysis?
Yeah, am I going to break it down? Am I going to break down the debate? Oh, no, actually, no, that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to dish out a healthy dose of transphobia.
No, because we wouldn't want anyone to perpetuate, of course, the stereotype of princess. That's not something that we would ever want there. You can be a little more timely there, Tim.
As long as you're a man.
Yeah, as long as you're a man. It's like, oh, no, listen. Listen, this is just, I believe I'm a woman. Really? How many transgender individuals are saying, I want to be a woman? Why? So I can become a scientist. No, they want to become a woman so they can have big old fake tits and clown makeup. Let's be really clear about it. Okay? And all of a sudden it's like, oh, Bruce Jenner is now Caitlyn Jenner, is dressed like a Barbie, wearing a corset with those dimensions, and is wearing a princess tiara. But hey, well, no, that's fine. Just not for biological women.
Well, do you see the example? She's like, oh, princess, what do you need? And she's like, why can't we call him scientist doctor? Because I don't call my son, oh, scientist, what do you need?
Oh, well, I don't
like, I don't believe he's
ever been to an accredited university.
Yeah, I don't believe that she has a degree for me to call her a
doctor.
Also,
one. Like, it's a bit early to be called. And I love how she referred to her husband.
What?
Yeah, her husband as my child's father.
Right.
What is it with labels in you? Like, is that not appropriate? Are you not husband and wife anymore? That's fine. You could say,
oh my God, I wouldn't be.
I don't know. Well,
I hope if you leave that you don't try and take any said finances from your child's father, since you're such a strong, independent
woman. That's true.
No.
Don't need rescuing.
No, I want my cake and eat it too.
So, Jenner. The great content mind for these guys.
It's unbelievable. The idea that, wait, you didn't become a woman to become a scientist?
Wait, the idea that he thinks, I mean, what's going on in his mind where he thinks that people are changing genders because they want just big boobs to play with? Like, no, people are changing genders so they're more comfortable with their expression. And then they're going, and yes, some are scientists, some are lawyers, like... What does he think? Like, they all just... I don't know.
Also, drag queens, notably not transgender people, for the most part. Yes. For the most part.
Exactly.
Who he's referring to is literally, like, men, like, performing as women, like, not actual transgender
people. Right. This is about the drag queens, like, reading to kids, right? That's what he's been freaking out about for years now.
I mean, he should know the difference because he has dressed up as a woman on multiple occasions.
Yeah. Is that why he did it?
I mean, honestly, like, this guy, no matter how much he tries to sort of run from himself.
Mom! 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 Why did you do that to me?
I mean, I feel like it feels like envy a little bit.
It is. There is some. Well, he's like saying, you want your cake and eat it too. Some of us can't have our cake or eat it.
Our dads won't even let us have the cake in the first place.
Some of us have our fathers breathing down our neck and can't be the people we were meant to be.
When we dress up like that, we have to pretend like it's...
like a sketch, right. Like, we have to pretend like we're mocking people. There is such deep, dark darkness there. That they always return to that. Like, I mean, you just like contemplate, like, what is the impact of transgenderism in our society? Like, what measurable impact to people other than who are transgender really is there?
They act like they're coming for them.
I mean, think about like what has taken place just over the past, I don't know, like 5 weeks. People dying in floods in their own basements. Like, people like, you know, wildfires and thousands upon thousands of people dying because they're refusing to get vaccinated. How many stories have we just seen? There are probably more clips of people sitting in hospital beds saying, I wish I believed in the vaccine and gotten the vaccine, and crying and worrying about that they're not going to be there for their kids. We literally see more people than that. Than, first of all, transgender people that Steven Crowder will ever meet in his life, or that most people will ever meet in their lives. And we've probably seen like more people just like plea with other people to get the vaccine because they didn't do it and they're on their deathbed. But yet, it's the transgender. That is the fixation. It's really, I mean, you know, and I'm trying to get into the head of like, you know, somebody who sees this as a problem. Like all the things you have to, you know, it's like all the things you have to drive by on your drive to the gender.
Some conservatives are still talking about Afghanistan. You know, there's certain things like a big boy topics you could be talking about. But this is why Shapiro loves whenever like an athlete says they're dealing with a mental health issue, because they can just jump with both feet into like mocking that person, so they don't have to talk about, you know, the other things that are less useful to talk about.
This is like, honestly, they're doing a show for like sixth graders who have been, you know, like sort of sheltered and sort of prevented from, I mean, it's fascinating to me. Like they're grown men, they're grown people.
Yeah. Especially both Crowder and Shapiro. They started as younger people, but now they're getting in their 30s.
Yeah. I mean, come on, like, guys.
Like I'm feeling already like I wasn't as young as when I started here. Like you guys have been around
these
for
a long time. It is really amazing. Really amazing. All right. We're going to read some IMs. I think we've covered that. And we're going to read some IMs and then get out of here. Justin, phone today. I wanted to get the news out from the Pacific Northwest about a local radio host, Todd Herman. Rhetoric is affecting our area. I finally find out how right-wing he is. When I asked where he gets his news, I knew it. It was Breitbart, Fox, Epoch Times. But I've always felt he was libertarian. That is so close to understanding progressive point of view that when he talks to me, just a person about getting state help, but because of the radio show I tuned into today, he is anti-vaxxed, anti-mask. I can't believe it. Someone who helped take care of his dementia mother. I don't think he would vax or mask for her. I'm at a loss what to do. I'm dreadfully worried. Oh, wow. So it sounds like you knew this person off air. Eve One Haxor, Jimmy Dore has been added to the media bias chart that boomers love to post on Facebook at the far bottom left. I'm sure this is the final sign of the end times. Left is best, except for him. Not sure I fully understand that.
Insult to the far left.
Wayne Kerr. Oh, okay. Wayne Kerr. nice. Little disappointed you didn't touch on the Intercept reporting on gain of function research. Yeah, oh, bring that up. I mean, there was a report that came out that an assessment by some scientists who say that, in fact, the NIH was sort of like second order financing studies into gain of function research, which my understanding of it is when they take viruses and they sort of don't literally put them on steroids, but, you know, from as sort of a vernacular, they put them on steroids to make them more virulent as a way of studying them. I guess my theory about that, as far as I understand it, is, and somebody knows, but I don't, that the more virulent it is, the more its attributes are easier to examine. That same study apparently said it's highly unlikely that what they, based upon what they understood that those studies were doing, and includes like apparently at the Wuhan lab, that these things wouldn't have, were too dissimilar from COVID-19 to be the source of COVID. But who knows? There's no doubt in my mind that particularly, regardless of where COVID-19 came from, that we need to have tighter controls on this stuff because it can be really bad. I don't know that it really makes that much of a difference in the final analysis as in terms of like COVID itself as to where it came from.
I think there's a lot of implications that it's like the plandemic sort of people like to talk about this stuff a little bit and hint at things.
I mean, there is a greater gulf, it seems to me, between it coming from nature and it leaking out of it coming from nature and then leaking out of a lab. There's a greater gulf between it leaking out of a lab and it being planned than there is
exactly.
It coming from nature and leaking out of a lab. Gagagool. I was in D.C. 20 years ago. The people showed up to ineffectual protests against Supreme Court's Bush v. Gore decision in 2000 are the same folks who showed up to ineffectual marches against the Iraq War in 2003. Well, there were more for the war. There were more for the war. I was down in those D.C. protests. Butt sauce. Chris Rock had a bit about how Americans started coming together to hate terrorists, and that was cool, and then to hate foreigners, and that was cool, then to hate Muslims. And that's when Rock said, you know, black people and Jewish people are next. That train ain't never late. Emma Knight Shemalian. Hot take, South Park more than anything else ruined my generation. It taught us that caring was lame, that bigotry is cool and edgy, especially if you dress it up with ironic humor. I think there's something for that argument.
And that, like, being anti-war was sort of like, could be a Republican thing. I mean, maybe that wasn't an explicit message, but that was kind of a message I, and a lot of people in my early college got from that stuff.
Mm. Thames Darwin, Sam, like you, I heard the attacks happen live on Stern. I remember hearing about the landing gear on that first plane, but even more, I recall Stern reporting that a second plane had hit. Between parking my car on the lot and getting into my office and turning on the radio, they had gone on the warpath. It happened that quickly. Aaron is not cool. Can I get a shofar? It's my birthday, and I'm 34, and I'm finally writing and directing my first movie this year. Oh, congratulations. Awesome. I learned about Kaveh Zahadi from R.M. Brown, who stanned Zahadi and interviewed Zahadi. We're going to have R.M. Brown on soon. We should try and work on that. Columbo is dope, yo, says Monkey Spank. Fart sound. How Jewish is this film class? Will it be authentic Hollywood experience? Chris Burdick, Sam, if you do nothing else today, you've got to make a sound drop out of that moment when Matthew Film Guy said, I am a sex addict. Slappy Tub, Sam, could you talk about your thoughts when a plane crashed into Rockaway, I believe not long after 9/11? Yeah. Yeah, people are freaking out. There was a plane that crashed into, I think it had just taken off from LaGuardia. I can't remember exactly. But it was like 2 months later, maybe. It happened on November 12th, 2001. Remember? Yes. Governor HVAC. But between that and the anthrax and everything else, it was all just sort of like one big mishmash. Everybody was in a state of shock. The woman seen laughing at the kid in Rutherford County School Board has been identified as an employee at Cigna, and she has now been fired. Wow. Kowalski from Nebraska. Vaush is doing a 24-hour video game charity stream to raise money for Planned Parenthood starting today at 3 p.m. Given the state of the anti-choice crowd's assault on freedom of planning, Planned Parenthood needs all the support they can get. Yes, folks, check that out. Should we raid his Twitch? 3 p.m.? I don't think it's going up. Sam, what comparisons could you draw between the astroturfed Obamacare town hall response and the current right-wing school board agitation happening around the same time late in the summer, the first of the year of a first-term president? Well, you made a bunch of comparisons. There is been reports of the right-wing funding for these things. I think that it's the and it's a bank shock, right? On what they're attacking. But here's the difference. Obamacare was going to pass during this time. And I don't know that anti-masking, and we went through this with Ryan, is going to be as salient from now. NJ Connor, I wonder where those signs came from at that school board meeting. I mean, it has to be astroturfed, right? Well, I imagine that it is, there's money. MD lawyer, doomed yourself now. Jenna from St. Louis. I am a licensed massage therapist. Let me come rub you. Smiley face. I'm not sure. It's not that it's not the license. Real ace attorney. Damn, Sam, those 70 sideburns are unreal. Please never change them. The Chris Lopaco. Moloch is literally the major of my YouTube channel. Sam from Ottawa. Canada's English language debate was last night. The format and moderator made it into nothing but petulant children squabbling. The American influence continues. Sorry about that. Justin. Oh, what happened to... Do we have that clip? Didn't I put that clip in from Buffalo? Oh, we have it? Well, let's play it. Huh? I guess we'll do it Monday. We don't have time now. Okay. A couple more of these, and then we're out of here. Gagabool. Oh, wait, no, I already did that. Till. Sam, what comparisons could you draw? Oh, I did that one already, too. Jennifer from St. Louis. Yeah, okay. Ryan Cole. Palin's word salad is the direct precursor of Trump's slurred word salad. Indeed. Friend described libertarianism as astrology for men. Astrology makes more sense, in my opinion. 69. Bra, the non-aggression principle, bro. Cops will use lethal force to make sure nobody takes my private property that I inherited from my parents. I worked hard to be born to them, and I'll use that land for something important. Damien. Did you have to pee? I did, yeah. Sorry. Godcat, studio should be ready by 9:26. My birthday. I had reservations for Windows on the World 9:26:01. My 13th had to settle for Nobu. Also, come home, Brian. Be my husband. Okay, Bill O'Reilly's slate book: Killing Bin Laden, Obama's continuation of black on black crime. Big Dick Cheney energy. Weren't there multiple brawls at the Palin residence? The police had to break up. Weird. She's capable of being embarrassed for anyone else. Sam's only fan. Hey, Sam, can we please get Tom Hartman on to talk about his new book, Hidden History of American Healthcare? Very good stuff. Yeah, I think we can do that. Travis from Pittsburgh. Wow, Ben Shapiro is able to shove so much stupid into a short period of time. Two more IMs, and then we're out of here. Donda Defender. I think Donda was great. People get so wrapped up in the God of it all, they ignore that there's a song on there called Jesus Lord, but all that calls for free and available abortions criticizes America's foreign domestic policy. Cheers. And the final IM of the week. Chili Pecker, we just had statues removed from Richmond, too. I've had several people in my comments saying that Robert E. Lee is one of the good Confederates, as if he didn't also own slaves.
He's good in the sense that he sucked at being a general to the point where he lost a war he probably could have won.
There you go. That helped. All right, folks. Matt, Bradley, great job this week. See you folks on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie fall. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah.